Look around. Technology is all around us. We use it in every aspect of our lives. It enables us to do amazing things. But what if we could go further? What if we could go beyond the screen? Where your digital world is blended with your real world. Now we can. This is the world with holograms. What will they enable us to do? New ways to visualize our work.
You know, I have an idea for the fuel tank.
New ways to share ideas with each other.
How are things going your end?
I just put the images in OneDrive.
Perfect.
More immersive ways to play. New ways to teach and learn.
So put the new trap in the place of the old one.
Now what?
And tighten here and here.
New ways to collaborate and explore the places we've never been.
Look at this formation. Let's take a closer look.
And new ways to create the things we imagine. Because when you change the way you see the world, you can change the world you see. This is Microsoft HoloLens.
Hello, Siri. I'm Cortana. Oh no, you talk. Not just talk, I learn. Like what you like to read in the morning, your favorite kinds of restaurants. I can even tell you when to leave to help you be on time. You know, personal stuff.
Well, personally, I liked it better when you didn't talk.
We put the personal into computing. By democratizing technology, not putting it on a pedestal. By respecting everyone's privacy and encouraging their individuality. But we're not building another new operating system. We're building a deeply personal and incredibly empowering experience called Windows. Windows will be a natural evolution from innovations like Kinect and Cortana. It will be built from the ground up, embracing the things that make us human. It will power the tools that people use every day. Everything from PCs to ATMs, tablets to subways, phones to ultrasound machines. It will be energetic and alive, just like the people it's built for. It will enhance their whole world, not just their digital life. And it will give them a voice, then learn from and act on it. Windows will always be for people who do. Because people who do are the ones who move the world forward.
We want every meeting to be great, where things just click, where ideas flow and work gets done. The problem is, technology hasn't been designed for the way we want to work together, until now. With Microsoft Surface Hub, you can unlock the power of the group. You can walk up and share your ideas on a canvas as big as your imagination. You can touch the data you need to make key decisions on the spot. And anyone can pick up a pen to help drive the conversation. It's a platform that brings the tools you rely on to the center of the discussion and lets you interact in new ways. Whenever you need, you can bring the right person into a critical session. Meetings become more engaging and productive, and you can take your ideas with you when you leave the room. So make every meeting great. Introducing Microsoft Surface Hub. Unlock the power of the group.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage for your hosts today, Richard Conway and Andy Cross.
Well, thank you everybody for coming to Morning with Scott Goo. This is a UK is Your User Group event, and we are really happy to have Scott here. Microsoft have been really kind in helping us with all the logistics and sponsorship, and so everything should run smoothly, unlike last time. So some facts about UK Azure. If you don't follow us, this is our Twitter hashtag, UK Azure. We used to be UK Wall.
Hashtag, mate.
Oh, sorry, it's not a hashtag. Right.
That's a handle, mate.
That's a handle,
so,
yes.
So, good start.
Yeah, good start.
We've been running the UK Azure user group for, three and a bit years now.
Yep, that's right.
And, you know, we continue to grow. We have monthly meetings where we have community speakers who come and share their experience of Azure. And, you know, we have a good time in the pub. So, I mean, there's lots and lots of benefits to coming. You should follow us and sign up to our meetup group at UK Azure user group. So the only other thing to mention about the user group is that it's sponsored by ElastiCloud and for Hancock and Parsons, and you can meet all of us down in the lobby at the networking event after the Scott Goo session.
Okay. So these are all the amazing things that we're going to be putting on over the next few weeks. We didn't actually have any space on the slide for the other cool stuff that we're going to be doing, but tomorrow night we've got, I think there's about 20 places left.
Yeah.
For data analytics in the cloud, we've got a Microsoft speaker, Lara Rubelke, who's here from SQL Bits, so that promises to be really good. And then we've got some other things. Anybody that's new to Azure can come to the Global Azure Bootcamp on the 25th of April, which is the largest community event in the world at the moment. There are normally over 100 locations. This is the third year it's been running. It proves to be huge amounts of fun.
And while we've got your attention, I know there's a lot of people here who have come from around the country. The Global Azure Bootcamp is a global event. If you want to run an event in Birmingham, in Manchester, anywhere around the UK, then either come and grab us or go to global.azurebootcamp.com. I'll get that wrong. Just come and see us and we'll show you the actual URL. You can actually set up one of these. You get a lot of help from the people who organized it globally. And, you know, it's a great way for, in your locality, to set up a new Azure fan base, and you can all go and explore a lot of exciting things on the 25th.
Okay. Right, so I thought I'd throw this in. So I'm going to be abseiling from that building, which is 114 meters. So I thought I'd take this opportunity to promote this, because it's for a fantastically worthwhile cause. Please sponsor me, even if it's a couple of quid.
But there's another reason for having this slide up, which is that Just Giving are one of the community speakers that we are going to have later on today, after Scott's finished, and they're going to be talking about their implementation of a giving graph on Azure.
Absolutely. And in my experience of putting this on Just Giving, the giving graph actually worked. We've got a big data solution which worked on Azure. It found all of these people that I didn't think would sponsor me, and somehow they found out about this by creating this this graph behind the scenes that just really understood my my social environment.
And hopefully we'll learn about that.
We will, absolutely. And the other thing it did is it predicted exactly how much I would raise, and I thought, I'm not going to raise that much. And guess what? The machine learning was right, and I was wrong.
So before we get started, those of you who have been here before to our last large Scott Goo event, which was in 2012, will remember that we had a bit of a problem with networking. We never got a chance to thank the manufacturers of Ethernet cables, but last time we had someone run down from effectively the back of the auditorium with this enormous cable that Scott plugged in and got maybe, I don't know, a kilobyte a second sort of bandwidth on it, but he still managed to get through. It was a fantastic and very funny event. Hopefully we won't have any problems like that today. But if we do, at least now we've thanked the manufacturers, so we might have a bit more better
luck. Absolutely. We've got Ethernet cable today.
So thanks to Microsoft. Thanks to Scott. Thanks to you guys for coming. Please join our user group on meetup.com/UK Azure User Group and enjoy the day.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Scott Guthrie.
Thanks, everyone, for coming out here early this morning. And hopefully we have a pretty exciting day ahead with a lot of fun. The Ethernet cable thing, I should mention, this is sort of, I still wake up at night sometimes screaming, thinking about the last time I was at this event. I did not know you could get an Ethernet cable that was 300 meters long. There's a reason you don't usually see them. It's because you do get about a kilobyte of bandwidth through it. And so I was on stage, I think, for 4 hours giving a talk on cloud where we could not connect to the internet. And I ran out of, you know, every joke I knew about 3 hours and 45 minutes into the talk. I just felt like sitting in the corner and crying. But it was very cathartic, and it made me a better person. And I'm excited to be back here, and hopefully we will not repeat that experience again. So we got a lot of content here this morning, with a lot of people in the attendance. And I asked certain people ahead of time, kind of, what is the general makeup of the audience? And what I heard was kind of basically 50-50. 50% of people had no idea what cloud was, but thought this sounded like a good morning off. And 50% of people said they'd been doing cloud for 30 years and knew everything about it. And so can you create a talk that appeals to both? Which is kind of a little bit of a hard challenge. And so what I try to do here is put together a talk, which is really Azure end-to-end. So it's going to start basic. So for people that are in the Azure user group, you might know a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk about for the first 15, 20 minutes. And then we're going to steadily get more advanced and more advanced and more advanced as we go along. I have 128 slides and 18 demos. And I guarantee that many of them you haven't seen before because I finished the talk a few hours ago. Hopefully we'll cover some really cool stuff. In particular, I'm excited to show off some of the features that actually even I hadn't played with as much before this weekend, especially some of the new data services that are coming out. We'll show off some cool demos there. We got IoT, I've got big data, I've got machine learning, and a whole bunch more. And so with that, let's go ahead and get started. My contact detail, by the way, is up here, so feel free to send me email or tweet me if you have a question that doesn't get answered during the talk. And we'll have some Q&A at the end. And if you've got a really pertinent question at the time, feel free to shout out the question, and we'll hopefully make this a little interactive. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Ooh, and the clicker does not work. That was quick. First error of the day. There we go. So one of the things you know, that you hear a lot about right now from Microsoft is kind of a journey that we've been going through, in particular in earnest the last year, of really kind of pivoting our portfolio around kind of what we call a mobile-first, cloud-first world, and really looking at how do we actually kind of update all of our products, how do we really reinvent a lot of our products to really adapt and fit in great in terms of this world. And Azure and a lot of the things I'm going to be talking about today, whether it's in the data space, the Visual Studio space, the application development space, is really around that. One of the things I thought I'd just spend 5 minutes on up front, though, is something that I sometimes hear people a lot about, which is ask about, which is, hey, I hear cloud, cloud, cloud. Why should I care about the cloud? Anyone here wonder why they should care about the cloud? No one. Okay. That means either you're a perfect audience or you're all cowards. But so I just, you know, when people ask me sometimes, you know, how do I convince my boss or how do I convince my company that we should think about the cloud, we should adopt the cloud? And I usually kind of list off a couple of reasons that I thought I'd just quickly blitz through here as a way to kind of motivate what makes the cloud exciting and, you know, what makes it something that I think all of us are really going to be taking advantage of in a super deep way over the next couple years. And I kind of listed these ones up here real quick, and I'll go through each one, which is quick and easy deployment, elastic capacity, and the types of use cases that now enables, the ability to pay only for what you use, and some of the new business value scenarios that you can achieve with it. Now, the first one here is pretty easy, and once you see it, you kind of get it, which is really quick and easy deployment. The thing that I like the most about the cloud probably is this bullet right here, which is I never have to wait for provisioning again. I no longer have to go and request a server or go sit through a whole bunch of meetings where I have to kind of justify a capital expense. I can basically log into a browser, click, I want a new virtual machine, and I can choose anywhere around the world and have it stood up literally instantly for me to go ahead and use. The benefit from an organization perspective is you get much shorter development cycles where you're able to kind of move much faster and not kind of get blocked before you even start. And it really also changes a lot of how you kind of approach problems because it allows you to kind of deliver things much faster, often much more agilely, and can really change kind of how you approach things. And what I thought I'd do is just start things off is just do two quick demos to kind of motivate some of the speed and time to market. And for people that haven't kind of been exposed to the cloud or haven't been exposed to Azure, hopefully give you kind of a sense of what the possibilities are here. So how many people here build apps that use a database? Only half the people raised their hand. Cool. It's half as many as the last question. So we're working our way up. So you know, one of the things, you know, how long does it usually take you to get a database on a project you work on? How many people get it the same day that they request it? New database server. Okay, one person. How many people get it the same week? A couple more people. How many the same month? If you're lucky. How many within 6 months? So everyone else is beyond 6 months. Okay. So one of the things that kind of I thought I'd just do to kick things off is just create a database and kind of illustrate in the cloud how does that work. And so I'm in the Azure Management Console. You'll see this a lot. This is our new console, so it's not quite shipped yet, but it's available for preview. And I'm going to basically stand up a new SQL database in the cloud. What would you like to call this database? UK Azure. Hopefully no one else has taken this. And we can basically choose where we want to run it. I'm just going to run it in here. I can choose the size. I can set various settings. I can choose a subscription. I'm just going to go ahead and hit create. And this is going to basically go ahead now, and it's dynamically provisioning for me a new SQL database. I think I picked the west half of the U.S. just because I already have some resources there that we'll use a little bit later on in the demo. And basically what we did here is the portal basically fired a REST call to Azure and said, please stand up this database. Azure then basically provisioned one for us in the west U.S. region. It's now active. It's now running. I now have real utilization here, and I'm now good to go. And this is a full database. It's SSD backed in terms of storage. Gives me guaranteed IOPS and latency. It comes with an enterprise-grade SLA. And I'm completely isolated just to my particular services. It has built-in backup, built-in recovery. It gives me the option where if I want to enable DR around the world, I can set it up anywhere. You'll see that demo a little bit later on. And I'm now good to go. I can basically start working on my project. And so that's sort of simple example of just a common scenario that I think all of us from a development perspective have often asked for or wished for. And you can see here, I can literally stand it up in about 15 to 20 seconds anywhere around the world without ever having to wait again. So that's sort of simple hello world number one. So hello world number two is do something a little bit more complicated. How many people here work with SharePoint? Okay, a number of people. And you know, when you stand up a new SharePoint server farm, how many people stood up a new SharePoint server farm? A few people. How many people had fun doing it? It's a little bit of work. How long who can stand up a SharePoint server farm in a day? Well, okay, you're bold here. Most people tell me it's about a month. They're not as clever as you guys. But if you want to stand up sort of a SharePoint server farm with multiple databases, in a clustered environment, if you want to basically have a domain controller and environment, if you script it out, you can do it, but it's typically, a decent amount of tin you need to order, and then often a non-trivial operation in order to stand up. One of the things you can do in the cloud now within Azure is you can basically go ahead, and there's a bunch of different images for virtual machines you can stand up. You can see here we have an Oracle database. We also have a SharePoint server farm. This is a multi-VM template that we're going to activate here. And so I could create the UK SharePoint farm. Basically, give it a username, password. It's always good when I don't accidentally type my password and the username in front of the whole audience. You can see here, one of the things we enable you to do is configure, for example, like what is your domain controller configuration. You can set up your SQL databases and choose the size of the different VMs you want to run them in. I can attach it to a virtual network, including one that can bridge back to my on-premises network. I can choose where in the world I want to run it. And then, effectively, I can click this little box if I want to run it in high availability mode, in which case it'll be clustered, so it's actually running each critical instance at least two times on separate physical machines for high availability. And then all I need to do is hit create. This one takes a little bit more than 15 seconds. It's usually about 15 minutes. But at the end of it, I basically have a SharePoint farm fully stood up. This is sort of an example of one that I created earlier. You can see here when I run this, I get basically a view of the entire farm. For people in the back that can't see, let me zoom in a little bit. So you can see I have four domain names set up. I got nine virtual machines, and I also have a virtual network. And if I click that, I can see all the different virtual machines here for the application. And if I drill in, I can basically see settings about that virtual machine. This is sort of a very zoomed in. I can see the health CPU of this, and I can basically manage each of these individual resources as a group and have kind of a full management experience for that. Again, being able to stand that up anywhere around the world in about 15 minutes or so. So real easy way you can get started. You can build, you know, simple resources. You can build entire applications. You can quickly automate and stand them up anywhere. And again, never have to wait for anything. Now, the second element about cloud that I really like, and I think is pretty powerful, is this notion of elastic capacity, which is the power that you get where you can no longer need to wait on any resource. You no longer need to wait on physical infrastructure being enabled. But more importantly, you can now dynamically increase and decrease the amount of capacity you use, basically at will. The benefit around that is it basically means you can handle any unexpected load that you need. It gives you the ability to burst up for large amounts of capacity when you need it, and you can basically automatically burst down when you no longer need it. And this gives you kind of global coverage with pretty much unprecedented scale upon which you can run pretty much any scenario. You know, one of the things I often kind of talk to people about is, you know, how this ability to kind of have infinite amounts of capacity really changes the way that you build your applications and fundamentally makes you rethink a lot of the principles behind them. And, you know, often when I talk to people coming from an enterprise background, they say, that's kind of good. I get why Facebook needs that. I get why a consumer social network needs it. But I don't, you know, our company just doesn't need that many servers. And I think that's been true in the past, as we kind of think about some of the problems in the past. But in a world where you can basically spin up infinite amounts of capacity and then turn it off when you don't need it, it really changes the way you actually use capacity. And I think you'll find in any environment, including enterprise internal environments, having this type of capability really changes the types of solutions you can build and allows you to deliver much more business value. And I thought I'd just walk through kind of three example customers that are using Azure today. We're going to hear from some other ones after my talk. And talk about how they're taking advantage of this capacity to really change how they do business. The first one is a company called Milliman. Anyone here from Milliman today? They have a development shop in London, as well as Seattle. And I think they're a pretty cool company that's kind of gone through a pretty massive transformation in terms of how they've done business. I think they were created in either 1946 or 1947, and they do actuarial science work for life insurance companies, and other financial institutions. And basically, they can do kind of risk actuarial analysis and portfolio analysis on top of, say, an insurance company's portfolio of resources. And basically tell that company, you need to divest your portfolio, you need to buy this asset or that asset in order to balance out the risk that they're currently carrying. And, you know, starting out in the 1940s, that was a very people-centric activity. One of the things that they've really done over the last 10 or 15 years is transform themselves into a software company where they now deliver that service as a SaaS service to their own clients. And what's nice is they're able to use the cloud, so they don't actually have to have any physical data centers of their own, and they're able to basically run their application entirely on Azure. They can spin up infinite amounts of compute as they need it, and they can basically do Monte Carlo simulations and other risk analysis for that customer every night before the market opens the next day. And you know, they'll run up to about 50,000 compute cores for each of their individual customers. And the beauty about it is they're able to spin them up at night when they need them, and then during the day they just turn them off and they don't have to pay for anything. And the ability for them not to have to provision any, or buy any hardware and instead just dynamically spin it up and spin it down as needed really changes how they do business. And one of the things that they often talk about is they've never once had to turn down an emergency job from a customer that's needed an immediate run. They've always been able to have capacity, and they're able to actually have that capacity anywhere around the world so they can meet a truly global audience. Second customer here is one called AccuWeather. Anyone here use the AccuWeather app on their phone? A number of people do. It's one of the leading phone apps, or leading weather apps on a variety of devices, including mobile phones. They were originally an AWS customer. They actually switched to Azure. And you know, they're using the cloud basically not only to process all of the weather forecasting information, so they have a complex weather forecasting model, but they're also using the cloud to basically be the back end for all their mobile and web devices. They process about 8.4 billion requests per day for weather-related information. And again, they're able to scale up anywhere around the world and use just the capacity they need. And then the last one is Heineken. Anyone here have had a Heineken? Lots of hands. Okay. So obviously they're a beer manufacturer. And they're not using the cloud yet for beer manufacturing. Although that would be a fun use case that we'd love to help debug. But they're actually using it instead for all of their marketing campaigns. And they're using basically the cloud so that when they do a social marketing campaign, like a Facebook app or a Facebook game that they use to drive brand awareness, they can basically spin up the capacity they need anywhere around the world for the lifetime of that campaign. And then when the marketing campaign's over, they can basically drain the capacity down. And the beauty is, again, they don't have to pre-provision anything. They can just spin it up as they need it and spin it down when it's no longer needed. So three simple use cases from a kind of a more of an enterprise environment that kind of walk through kind of what you can do with this capacity. You know, beyond just saving money or doing new use cases, the other thing that's kind of cool is it really changes the types of problems that you can now actually attack and the types of apps you can now build, and really gives you the flexibility to do kind of pretty remarkable things you just couldn't do before. A number of the biggest customers that run on Azure today are actually gaming companies, and they're using the cloud basically to spin up, in some cases, you know, 300,000 or 400,000 servers for a launch event, a virtual servers, and then basically they turn them off as the event's over or as it winds down, because games typically are fairly cyclical in terms of nature. One of the largest ones, games that use the cloud that went out about a year ago, is a game called Titanfall. They're required cloud connectivity, so you could not play the game if you could not connect to the cloud. And they spun up, I think, 350,000 compute cores for launch day all around the world in order to actually run the experience. And I thought, since it's a cool video and it's got loud sounds and it's a good thing to wake us up in the morning, play a quick video of it in action and them talking.
Traditionally, building any sort of server technology has been pretty difficult for any developer. We saw cloud computing as an opportunity to introduce hands-off, scalable, on-demand resources so game developers could focus more on the game.
What that means is there's data centers all over the globe, and when you start up the game, it figures out where you are and what the best connection to which data center you have is. And it'll spin up a server, a dedicated server in a server farm for you, fast connection with, you know, fast CPUs.
We can maximize what we're doing, knowing full well that on the back end, we have power there to take advantage of the game.
It makes matchmaking really quick, and then once you're in the game, it's a really consistent experience.
It's a more even experience. There's no host advantage. There's no worry about who's hosting what, and do we have to now reserve performance on everybody's machine?
So you don't have people doing lag switch killing. You don't have host migration. You have just solid gameplay that's fair for everybody. If anyone asks for a server, just throw them a server. And we replenish that pool from the cloud. And so when we need another one, we just grab it down, put it in our pool, and then hand it out to somebody. So it's this constantly available set of servers all over the globe for anyone.
But one of the things we're seeing that's really amazing about Titanfall is the idea that a lot of the AI and the non-player character is actually powered by the server.
That would not be feasible to do on a game that's client-hosted.
For the first time, I think users are seeing why server technology is really going to make next-generation gaming that much better.
Cool. You know, I think what's kind of cool about it is, besides the fact that they blow things up and it's a lot of sound, is, you know, is just the fact that, you know, Respawn, which is the company that built this game, you know, is 90 people. And, you know, they basically built, you know, experience they could have go live simultaneously for millions of customers, you know, literally use hundreds of thousands of virtual servers around the world, and they didn't actually have to go pay really any money up front in order to actually deploy that. And they were able to kind of build that type of experience and do those types of scenarios. And, you know, whether you're doing it for a consumer-like scenario, whether you're doing it around data analysis and machine learning, whether you're doing it to build better web and mobile experiences, this kind of ability to kind of go broad anywhere around the world, scale up to anything that you need, really changes the way you think about apps, and it makes it a lot more fun to be a developer. Now, economics is another reason or why the cloud is kind of compelling. As I mentioned, you know, the nice thing about this sort of that Titanfall game and that 90-person shop is they didn't have to go buy hundreds of millions of dollars of infrastructure or even millions of dollars of infrastructure. They had basically had no upfront costs. They didn't have to have a long-term commitment. They didn't have to promise to use these servers for a year. They were able to basically send a REST call, spin up the capacity, deploy their application, and, you know, when they didn't need it anymore, they could basically start dropping that connectivity or dropping those resources down, and they paid only for what they used. And, you know, I think if you look at any application you have today, whether it's a web app, whether it's a mobile app, whether it's an internal server that you're using to kind of power your line of business applications within the firewall, you know, I think what you typically see in those types of situations is a usage pattern that looks a lot like this, where there's times of the day when your app's used a lot, and there's times of the day when they're not. This is actually a fairly even pattern, you know, especially for a lot of corporate apps. Saturday and Sunday tends to be much quieter in terms of CPU utilization. How many people on average, in any sense right now, the servers that you have inside your organization, whether it's a startup or whether it's an enterprise, what do you think the typical utilization of your servers is? 10%, 5%, 20%. That's about right. I mean, typically we see, you know, I'll give you an example, Microsoft internal servers, we average about 8.9% utilization. And when people hear that, especially our chief financial officer, what in the world are you guys doing? You're crazies. And it's not because the servers are sitting idle all the time. They're often at near 100% or 80% utilization. But they're definitely, you know, when you average in overnight, you average in the weekends, you average in the holidays, that's what drops that average way down. And in a traditional kind of deployment environment, you know, that's sort of just to be expected, and you just kind of lose that waste. And because typically, you know, in an on-premises environment, you typically procure your servers for what you think the peak is plus a little bit more. So peak plus 15% is a common rule that a lot of people use. And that basically means, you know, during those trough periods, you know, you've got wasted, unused capacity. The beauty about the cloud, because you can elastically scale up and scale down, means that not only can you take advantage of vast amounts of resources, but it means that you can basically tailor your utilization based on only what you need. And so you can dynamically spin up and spin down your capacity to be just slightly 15% higher than what you actually need at this particular point in time. And that ability to kind of scale up and scale down and pay only for what you use yields enormous cost savings. And that's, you know, another key reason to think about using the cloud. Another customer of ours that's in Australia and also branching out all across Asia, I think they're now in 29 countries, it's a company called CarSales. You can go to carsales.au.com, I think is their domain name for their primary site. And it's a great example of a customer. They're .NET, they're Windows, they're SQL. And they were previously had their own data center and then managed hosting environment. And they in the last 2 years, migrated to Azure. And one of the things that the founder that I was talking to a couple months ago when I visited Australia said was it literally dropped an entire zero off of his IT budget because he was able to basically, he realized, dynamically scale up and scale down only for the number of servers that CarSales needs. They're the largest classified ads provider in Australia. But what they found was people don't buy cars in the morning in Australia. They typically buy them after work in the evening. And so they can run the entire site on six servers at 8 or 9 a.m. in the morning. And then basically by 4 or 5 p.m. in the afternoon, they make sure they have about 96 servers spun up. And then come 10 o'clock at night, they start turning them off again. And that ability to effectively have more than half of the day, you know, run on, you know, effectively 6 or 7% of the capacity they needed at peak, literally cut their budget by an enormous amount. And that's, again, the type of savings you can get. And then last but not least, you know, the great thing about the cloud is it really enables you to do, provide new business value to your organization. It enables you to build new experiences that enable you to connect better with customers, whether it's, you know, you're a startup or whether you're an enterprise that wants to basically get more in touch with your customers. It allows you, by having this capacity, to be able to use new techniques around big data, machine learning, and be able to process data and get deep insights in a deeper way. And it allows you to create and use the Internet of Things, which is going to be also kind of a pretty dramatic transformation that's going to change the way that we work with things. And we'll see some demos of that a little bit later. And it really kind of, again, transform your business in terms of how you kind of connect and operate. And again, these are just a couple of other customers that are on Azure today. GE Healthcare is kind of putting healthcare data systems into hospitals and to businesses around the world. And they store, you know, critical sensitive data inside Azure and can take advantage of the compliance we provide for medical data to do it. Blinkbox here in the UK. Anyone here from Blinkbox? No? Anyway, they're, anyone here use Blinkbox? A few people. They provide media streaming through Azure and kind of enable a rich set of media scenarios. And a company called Takanaka that I kind of like to reference is a great IoT scenario from Japan. And they're basically putting IoT sensors into buildings, and they're kind of a general contractor in Tokyo and some of the large cities where they have giant skyscrapers. And they're basically have instrumented all their buildings with IoT sensors, and using machine learning are doing a bunch of interesting things in terms of building management and maintenance. So again, three radically different use case scenarios, but talk just a little bit about kind of what you can do. So, you know, at the end of the day, I'm excited about cloud. I think you should be excited about cloud. And, you know, what's cool about this is it not only, you know, is great for your business, but makes developers much more valuable to those businesses as well, because it suddenly means that your creativity and what you can, or your what you can build is really only limited by your creativity. And, you know, again, enables you to be much more valuable in terms of what you provide. So what is Azure? So basically, Azure is Microsoft's cloud computing platform. It's something we started a couple of years ago and now runs all around the world. And it basically really allows you to take advantage of the cloud, enables you to build next-generation experiences with it, and we think it's pretty differentiated in terms of how it does it. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of the talk going deep on. What's nice about Azure is it really allows you to take the best of a whole bunch of worlds and use them together. Specifically, it allows you, we started with Azure focusing on what we call platform as a service capabilities, which are very vertical scenarios that allow you to, services that allow you to be immensely productive as you build your apps. One of the things we've added in the last 2 years is infrastructure as a service capabilities as well, which allows you to take any virtual machine and be able to host it and run it inside Azure as well. And the ability to use both these platform as a service capabilities and infrastructure as service capabilities together is really unique and differentiated. Azure is also very open, so you can take the best of the Microsoft and Windows ecosystem, you can take the best of the Linux and open source ecosystem, and you can use them together. And the ability to kind of use PaaS and IaaS, Windows and Linux, all the types of services that you want to be able to take advantage of, and have great development tools, a great management experience all together, we think is pretty unique. We've been hard at work at Azure, and so there's lots and lots of features that we're coming out with. I have sort of a slide of just a few of them. I think in general we do about 500 updates now a year of new features, so it's constantly moving. I have to constantly update this deck. You know, I think you'll find this talk even 6 months from now will be out of date, and there'll be a lot more capabilities. But it makes it kind of a fun, pretty dynamic environment where you're constantly getting new value, and we're constantly iterating on your feedback to provide an even better service. And we're seeing a lot of success and traction right now in the market. We have about 10,000 new customers a week signing up for it. We've got over 1.2 million SQL databases now actually hosted inside Azure. We've got more than 35 trillion objects in our Azure storage system, which is a lot of objects. We've got about 350 million users in our identity security system. And we process about 18 billion authentications each week. And you might ask, that's a lot of people logging in, and that is a lot of people logging in, but it's also more increasingly OAuth and SAML-based access control tokens that have been giving out to mobile apps, and we provide a rich way that you can effectively integrate security throughout all your systems using it. We got 2 million developers now registered with Visual Studio Online, which provides a rich set of developer SaaS services, things like build servers, Kanban boards, work item tracking, Git-based source control repositories. And we have people that are increasingly using a lot of these higher-level services that you'll see me walk through later today. In terms of how Azure is different, obviously there's several other cloud vendors in the market. People often ask, what makes Azure unique? I often show these three kind of circles of capability that kind of overlap in a unique way in terms of what Azure provides. And it's basically hyperscale, enterprise-grade, and hybrid. And we like to say with Azure, we're really the only one that provides all three. With hyperscale, basically Azure's runs all over the world. We've got 19 regions open for business. And a region basically is a cluster of multiple data centers where you can basically run and deploy your code. So each of these green dots is someplace that you can effectively say, stand up my database, stand up my virtual machine here. The only two dots here that aren't open yet are the two that are opening up in India in a few months. Everything else is now open around the world. Put that in perspective, AWS has about 11 regions open for the world today, and the Google Cloud has three. And so from a reach perspective, we basically give you kind of the broadest reach of anything. We're also the only cloud vendor that runs inside mainland China. We have both a Shanghai and a Beijing region. And that basically gives you the option, if you want to enter the Chinese market, of also deploying your application and reaching that market as well. Here within Europe, we've got two regions open today. We've got others that will be coming soon. And those are our North Europe and our West Europe region. North Europe is in Ireland and our near Dublin, and our West Europe is near Amsterdam. And one of the things we always promise about any of our geographies is that we never have the data leave that particular geo. And so any data you put in either of those regions never leaves the EU. And we basically guarantee that and provide kind of full compliance support to basically mandate that. That's true likewise in other regions around the world. So if you deploy your app in Australia, you don't have to worry about the data ever leaving Australia and so forth. And that gives you kind of a way, especially if you're in a regulated industry or you're targeting the public sector, you can basically build and deploy these applications and reach any market. What makes these individual regions impressive is not just that there's many of them, but also the size of them. Basically, each of our data center buildings are about one rugby pitch in size. Does this look like a rugby pitch? Dude, this was hard to do. When I give this, usually it looks like a football field. Rather than just change the text, I had someone actually come up with what a rugby pitch looks like. And I have to confess, as I plugged it in last night, I was like, I have no idea if this is right. You can actually park two jumbo jets in each data center. This is actually a feature we don't like to use very often. But it gives you another dimension of size in terms of the buildings. And then what's kind of impressive is for our mega hub regions, like Dublin and Amsterdam are both mega hubs, we actually have up to 16 data center buildings in the same location, which is effectively enough servers to run 600,000, enough space to run 600,000 servers in each Azure region. Remember, we have 19 regions open for business around the world. And so we do now manage millions of servers, and that gives you kind of unprecedented scale and capacity that you can basically take advantage of anywhere. So hyperscale is one element, and I talked about earlier some of the use cases for hyperscale. How do we differentiate versus some of the other hyperscale vendors out there? And we basically think there's really only going to be about three hyperscale vendors out there in the world, basically us, Amazon, and Google. The way we look to differentiate is really on the other two dimensions, which is enterprise-grade and hybrid. On the enterprise-grade front, we're investing heavily in terms of providing a cloud that provides kind of the expectations and the needs for targeting enterprises or startups and ISVs that want to target enterprises. For people that look at the magic quadrant of Gartner, this is kind of the holy grail of enterprise computing. Gartner has four cloud surveys. It's a big deal when you're in a magic quadrant. We're the only one that's a leader in all four of the Gartner cloud magic quadrants. Amazon's in two of them, Google's in none of them. We also, from a certification perspective, I think now have more certifications than any other cloud vendor around the world, including here in the UK, the G Cloud IL2 certification, which allows you to target, for example, the UK public sector and government. We have similar ones for the US. IRAP is an Australian government requirement, and so forth. We have PCI DSS compliance, so if you want to store credit card data and do financial transactions, you can. We have EU model clauses. We have HIPAA for insurance and a whole bunch more. And so we have a list on our site of, I think, 27 certifications right now. We're also then hard at work in terms of improving the performance and improving the core capabilities of the platform so you can run even the most demanding enterprise mission-critical workload. One of the things we rolled out about 6 months ago is our new D family of virtual machines. These are all SSD-backed, very fast processors, and are great for compute. We also, just earlier this year, launched our new G family of virtual machines, which are actually the largest virtual machines on the in the cloud today. They're optimized for data workloads. They support up to 32 CPU cores of the very latest Intel Haswell processors, and they support up to half a terabyte of RAM and almost 7 terabytes of local SSD. And they're big honking machines. And the reason we call them the G series is in honor of Godzilla. That was the code name of the project, and marketing was nice and let us actually keep that. And again, they provide kind of the largest virtual machines in the cloud. The other thing that we're hard at work at, and you'll see us release in just a few weeks, is our new Azure Premium Storage offering. This is available in preview today. We're looking to have the GA version of it out shortly. This allows you to attach up to 64 terabytes of remote durable storage to each of your virtual machines. You can drive more than 50,000 disk IOPS per VM off of this storage system, and we basically provide less than a millisecond of read latency. These are some of the best performance numbers out there in the industry. And the combination of the virtual machines, the Godzilla SKU, the premium storage, you know, basically starts to mean that there's almost no workload that you can't run in the public cloud using Azure. And it gives you kind of unprecedented power and performance. So what I thought I'd do is let's do another demo. So just to kind of illustrate it a little bit, I'm going to show off some of the performance benefits that you can now get using this hardware. And so I basically got a couple of virtual machines here that we're going to flip through and just run a little bit of disk iometer perf testing tools with it. And basically this is just a simulated workload that's hitting the disk and going to allow us to measure the number of IOPS, the number of I/O instructions or operations per second, and then also measure the latency that we're getting off of that disk. And the first one demo I'm going to do is our what's called standard I/O. This is what we've had for the, sort of the last 2 years with our VM infrastructure. And it basically allows you to mount a remote disk that's durable, which means it's written at least 3 locations before a transaction commits. So you don't have to worry about the data being lost if a machine blows up. And it's remote, so it survives even when a virtual machine is torn down. And if I basically go ahead and run this, you can see if I zoom in here, this number where the mouse cursor is, it's about 420. Basically, I get between about 500 on average disk IOPS once it warms up. And you can see here down by the latency response time, well, you can't see because it's zoomed out, but in general, where does it go there? You know, from an average response time, you're getting about 30 milliseconds of response. So it's okay for a lot of tier two workloads. It's okay for a lot of dev test, but doesn't necessarily give you the performance you need if you've got a high volume database that needs to be hitting that disk or be able to save things. So let's go ahead and show off the new premium I/O option. So this is in public preview today, and you can sign up and start using it now. And again, we're going to make it generally available, meaning you don't even have, it's got a full SLA behind it in a few weeks' time. So if I run this exact same workload now, with one disk, you can basically see now we're about 10x faster in terms of disk IOPS. And then more impressively, from a response time perspective, you can see it's now under sub-millisecond response time. So that as you're accessing the disk, it takes less than a millisecond to read from it as you're doing these operations. So you can now basically run a workload with 10x the throughput just by having that one disk. What's nice, though, is you can have many disks, and you can stripe them all together to make them look like one logical partition on the VM, so one C drive, for example. This is another test here with that same capability on the D series, where I have 32 disks. And if I zoom in now, you'll see I now have 61,000 IOPS. And from a millisecond read time perspective, it's also looking really good. This now lets you run big honking workloads. And I'd say 99.some% of databases in the world would be more than fast enough with 50 or 60,000 disk IOPS, and you can take advantage of. And then for people that say, yep, but I want to go even bigger, this is our new G5 series machine. This is the largest machine we have right now. This is, again, about 6.5 terabytes of local SSD, half a terabyte of RAM, 32 cores of processing. And let's see what this looks like. So we run this same test. So this is going against the local ephemeral disk. And zoom in. And whoa. I made this 300% so people in the back can see. But you can see here basically 97,000 IOPS, where it looks like we're hitting right now. And you'll see the latency time is 0.32 milliseconds in terms of read and write. This is pretty freaking fast. You can pretty much run any workload, I think, on this system. And this is just disk I/O we're looking at. Again, you've got like half a terabyte of RAM that you can also take advantage of, and 32 of the latest Intel Haswell processors, which I think we're the only ones in the public cloud that offer today, that you can do on a compute side. And so this type of capability lets you really run pretty much anything out there. What's nice about this stuff as well is, just like I showed creating a SQL VM, just like I showed how to create a SharePoint farm, you can literally go in the portal, click, and you got one of these anywhere around the world that you basically want to deploy it. And so this ability to kind of have this power at your fingertips, take advantage of it, and then when you don't need it, turn it off, and you stop paying for it, again, really transforms how you think about jobs, how you think about projects, and you know, really transforms how you build solutions in a pretty big way. Beyond just sort of providing performance, we're also trying to make it really easy. You can run anything inside this infrastructure. And one of the things that we launched a couple months ago is something called the Azure Marketplace, where you can basically get pre-built apps and pre-built infrastructure solutions that you can deploy on top of this infrastructure. Whether it's Windows workloads like SharePoint, Windows, SQL, or other workloads like Linux. We have like 5 or 6 different Linux distributions you can choose from. You can stand up Oracle databases. You can stand up DB2 database system, IBM. You can stand up WebSphere systems, SAP systems, Informatica systems, big data things like Cloudera, Hortonworks, and DataStack. All these things are available in the marketplace. Super easy to basically stand up, again, with just a few clicks, directly integrated into the portal. And then last but not least, how we differentiate is with some of the hybrid capabilities that we provide. We're the only hyperscale cloud vendor that actually runs software inside your data center as well. And we basically provide a set of services that make it really easy for you to attach any of your existing on-premise infrastructure to the cloud, whether it's storage, backup, your identity servers for identity, DR capabilities, SQL replication, et cetera. We make it really easy. And then we also have an option we call the Azure Pack, which basically you can download and run on top of your existing Windows servers and System Center infrastructure, so you can have an Azure experience inside your firewall as well. This flexibility, again, on the hybrid side, coupled with enterprise grade, coupled with the hyperscale capability, we think really provides a nice sweet spot option. It's great to run your business, and that's one of the reasons why we kind of bill ourselves the cloud for modern business, and it really enables you to handle pretty much any scenario. So that was kind of the intro to Azure. So for people that have no idea what the cloud is or no idea what Azure is, hopefully you know a little bit now. Let's now dive deep and let's actually start building apps for it and walk through some of the capabilities of what it provides. How many people here have actually built an app on Azure? Okay, about half. Okay, cool. For people that have and for people that haven't, this slide kind of talks a little bit about what we provide. I mentioned earlier we provide both infrastructure capabilities as well as platform as a service capabilities. And this diagram kind of roughly outlines each one of them in terms of what we deliver. And what's nice about Azure is you can basically use them together. And the last section of this talk We're going to talk about management and some of the new things coming out that allow you to actually build a single logical application that contains resources from both and actually deploy it as a single atomic unit and manage it as a single atomic unit using our new management and role-based security APIs. And this ability to kind of pick and choose what you want, what you need in order to build your solution, we think is pretty differentiated and unique. What's great is you can also build it using all different types of tools and languages. So we have great Visual Studio and .NET support, but we also have great Java support, Node.js support, Python support, PHP support, Ruby support, and others. And so you can basically choose which SDK you want to use, and pretty much all of our services are available in all those languages, or will be shortly. I'm going to drill in briefly now into the IaaS space. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about IaaS since it's not that hard to explain, and I've already showed off some of the performance capabilities. And then I'm going to spend the bulk of the time walking through a bunch of our platform as a service capabilities, in particular talking about a lot of the new data analytics capabilities, which my guess is most people haven't seen yet. On the virtual machine side, so this is kind of the bread and butter of being a cloud vendor. And you know, the nice thing about virtual machines is they basically allow you to run pretty much anything you want within them. And within the Azure kind of core infrastructure space, we allow you to run Windows VMs, Linux VMs. We have a rich, powerful set of virtual networking support. And then we allow you to kind of obviously have storage and be able to store anything as well within them. You can create virtual machines in a couple different ways. You can use our management portal. And in the same way that I can create a virtual machine or I was able to create kind of a SharePoint farm, I could also just say, let's create a Windows Server 2012 virtual machine in the portal and basically configure that here. I can also create, for example, like an Ubuntu server and be able to configure that as well here. With the Ubuntu, I can basically specify a password, or if I want to, just paste in an SSH public key if I want to be passwordless and use SSH instead. And you can see here I can basically manage and configure everything here directly inside the management console. How many people here are using Visual Studio? Cool. So here's another cool option you can do. Let me... switch to that while I do that. If you install the Visual Studio management tools, or sorry, if you install the Azure SDK, one of the things we add is in the Server Explorer a new Azure node that'll show up, which basically allows you to connect to Azure and you can use it to effectively create and manage your virtual machines directly inside the IDE. And so if you want to, you can go ahead and just directly inside here also say create virtual machine. Let you pick whatever subscription you want. And in the same way, you can manage through the management console to create VMs. You can also create it. I think I'm going to have to zoom out just a tiny bit since it's sort of like looking through a straw right now. But you can see here basically I can also walk through, pick an image, and specify the exact same things I could do in a management console. So a really easy way, directly inside Visual Studio, you can also create virtual machines. You can also go ahead, and if you've got an existing VM that you want to go into, like this demo VM I created last night, you can also directly now inside Visual Studio shut down, restart, configure it. The Enable Debugging extension is a pretty cool one. It basically allows you to automatically turn on debugging extensions inside the virtual machine so you can then remote attach and debug remotely anything running within it. And then if you use the Connect using Remote Desktop, which you can also obviously do inside the management console, we basically allow you to, oops, it's on this other machine, connect to the VM. And basically now I'm logged into this remote VM running in Europe, and I can basically manage it and use it just like a local VM running on my own machine. So very easy way, you can very quickly basically create a VM, manage the VM, and likewise, you know, inside the management portal, when you do it, you can bring up this VM inside the management experience, and you can get kind of a full monitoring view on top of it. And again, if you want to log in and manage it directly, you basically, directly in the management console, just click that Connect experience and it'll launch that same remote session for you to use. Couple of kind of the features that we've come out with over the last year, you can also now take advantage of using virtual machines. And we'll talk a little bit more about command line management and more sophisticated management a little bit later. But one of the things we now support is the ability when you can stand up and create a virtual machine to effectively take what we call a snapshot image of it, which basically gives you the ability to have a template that you can then use to create new virtual machines. This provides a nice way if you want to stamp out an image or create a master image, you can do that. And, for example, have SQL with multiple disks on it. You can basically create an easily duplicatable image that you can then create any number of instances of. We also have added support for Puppet, Chef, as well as PowerShell. It's called the desired state configuration manager inside Windows. So that if you'd rather, you can also now go ahead and stand up new virtual machines, create configuration scripts that you store, for example, like in a Puppet master if you're using Puppet, or a Chef server if you're using Chef. And then when you basically create VMs, we have an API where you can pass in the Puppet agent details, and that will allow your VMs to stand up and then automatically provision themselves as part of the scripts that you like to write in order to actually stand up and run that infrastructure. So whether you're using Puppet, Chef, PowerShell, you can get full customization support for all the infrastructure images that you create. Other built-in features of our virtual machine support include load balancing and what we call high availability. We have a notion we call availability sets that you can put virtual machines into when you stand them up. And basically with an availability set, we guarantee that the VMs will run on separate physical servers. So in the event of a server going down, you know that you're not taking out all of the VMs within that particular availability set. So this is a great feature to always take advantage of, which will guarantee much more high availability. The other nice thing about availability sets is if we ever patch the host server, in which case we have to reboot the VM, we guarantee that we always stagger the when we reboot the servers so that you always have your core VMs always up and running, and we never take down every VM inside the availability set. With a load balancer, you can then basically have a single IP address that you then load balance traffic to multiple VMs within your deployment. This is another way you can very easily scale out your infrastructure. And this is all coordinated so that if a VM goes unhealthy, the load balancer will detect it and automatically distribute the traffic to the other systems. And so there's a bunch of great articles and tutorials you can read in terms of how to do this. You're going to see a couple updates coming out over the next couple months. We'll be able to manage each of the individual endpoints, like a load balancer and availability set, as distinct things, which will also allow you to script out even more advanced configuration scenarios. We have built-in networking support inside Azure, which basically allows you to create what we call virtual networks, where you can basically define your own IP address range, your own subnets, and basically use them to kind of create more complex topologies within your applications. You can put virtual machines on them. You can now put websites on them, as well as some of our PaaS services on them as well. And it basically gives you a private network that you can leverage and use as you're building your solutions. The other nice thing about virtual network, and you'll actually see us, I think, going forward, I think even now, when you create a VM now through the management portal, by default, we're now creating a virtual network for you and adding that VM onto it, just because we see it as such a common option that people like to be able to take advantage of. We also then can allow you to use virtual networks with hybrid networking support so that you can connect between two Azure regions and have a single network, say, for example, between West Europe and our North Europe region, and have a single private network for your applications that span the two. You can also take advantage of and connect a virtual network to your on-premises corporate network. We support an option called point-to-site, where you can have an individual server on your network at work connect to that virtual network in the cloud. We also support what's called site-to-site, which allows you to take your entire on-premises network or a subset you define and attach it to the cloud. And we also now have something called ExpressRoute, which gives you the flexibility where if you wanted to partner with a local telecommunications company, like, say, BT here in the UK, you can have dedicated fiber between our data center and your data center and basically channel all of that traffic across a guaranteed physical network. So lots of options, gives you lots of flexibility, And basically, the combination allows you to pretty much run any type of application you want inside our cloud. Any quick questions on infrastructure before I move on to PaaS? Sure. Yeah, so a couple questions there. So one question was around, taking two or three parts. So one question was around what guarantees do we provide around data sovereignty? And so one of the things we basically guarantee is when you store data inside a particular region inside Azure, by default, the data never leaves the region. You yourself can control if you want to set up for like DR purposes or geo-replication to copy the data into another region. But we basically guarantee the data will never leave the region unless you explicitly configure and change that. And so that's kind of one of the core promises that we provide. And we try to make sure we always have two regions inside each kind of geopolitical entity. So like the EU, we have West Europe and North Europe. But primarily so that you can know that you can set up a disaster recovery scenario in the event of like a meteor slamming into one part of the world. You know that there's another region at least 500 miles away that you can basically fail over your systems to and never have that data leave Europe. But again, you'd control that and you have the flexibility to say, no, I only want to run it in Ireland, or I want to be able to have a DR situation in two places inside the EU. And you'd be able to basically control and specify that. In terms of how things like, from a legal perspective, can different countries subpoena and you know say, hey, I want access to the data? There is something called the EU Model Clause between the U.S. and Europe, as an example. And so there is a legal framework that companies can subpoena data from other countries. So U.K. Government could subpoena data from the U.S. and the U.S., the U.K., et cetera. But there is kind of a legal framework and it has to go through courts. And so in the same way that if someone subpoenaed a document or something off of a local hard drive of an employee in another company, it would go through that. One of the things that we've recently published is our set of privacy clauses. And I think the international... but it's basically a set of legal frameworks in terms of how we do it. And we basically guarantee, you know, that you're always notified if there's a legal claim, and we basically contest and fight in court every legal claim and involve the customer in that case. And so you can basically leverage our legal department to basically provide protection. You know, there are cases, you know, that are I don't think we've ever had a national security case. But it's usually, you know, it's tax fraud or something like that. But again, it goes through the normal court process. That the same would if it was paper documents on premises. In terms of UK locations and regions, we haven't announced anything, but we are constantly opening new regions around the world. And you know, I do expect to see over time, you know, pretty much every large country have cloud regions UK is a large country, so how was that for a non-answer answer? But good question, yeah. And you know, I think especially on the there's a lot of fear around data sovereignty and things like that. We have a trust center on Azure, the Azure website that you can go to, that also has a lot of information around that. And one of the reasons why we got the G Cloud certification. From the UK government specifically, is it is also a set of additional compliance rules that are needed for UK public sector data, and we fully comply and meet with those. So let's switch gears now and talk a little bit about the platform as a service capability. So you know, I feel pretty good with our infrastructure capabilities, especially with things like premium storage, which is coming out shortly, that from a core infrastructure side, whether it's VM sizes, disk performance, and so forth. We have a pretty flexible, powerful system that you can take advantage of. But infrastructure is kind of table stakes in some ways in terms of the cloud. Everyone needs to have it. You need to have good ones. But you know, where I think increasingly cloud vendors are looking to differentiate more is in these sort of platform services and the ability to use both of them together, which makes it truly unique. And so why don't we just spend the bulk of the rest of the talk talking about this platform as a service capabilities and what are some of the unique things you can do with it. We're going to talk about web, we're going to talk about mobile, we're going to talk about data, we're going to talk about machine learning, we're going to talk about search, analytics, and a whole bunch more. And I think this is sort of some of the special sauce that Azure provides and some of the unique capabilities you can do with it. How many people here are doing web applications? Cool. How many people here are using ASP.NET? Yay. How many people are using Node.js? Yay. Okay, cool. How many people here are using PHP? Boo. Okay. No, we love them all. They're all great. And if you're using it here, I would say yay too. But since no one actually raised their hand, we can make fun. So one of the things we provide with Azure, obviously you can stand up a VM and you can provision whatever web server you want, deploy your code within it, take advantage of the load balancing, and basically deploy a web solution. The downside with that, though, is you're having to deal with a lot of the infrastructure yourself. You're having to patch the VMs. You're having to kind of set up your own deployment systems and your own monitoring systems. And so one of the things that we provide with Azure is something called the Azure Web Service, or website service, which basically allows you to not have to worry about a lot of that stuff and allow us to handle that infrastructure for you. And it basically does a bunch of things. One is it allows you to build apps using a wide variety of languages, so .NET, Node, PHP, Python, and Java. We support multiple Java containers, including Tomcat, as well as others. And it basically handles, with the Azure Website Service, load balancing, networking, deployment, continuous integration, all that for you. And you can basically deploy, whether it's with FTP, you can do a Git push, you can hook up continuous integration from GitHub, or from Visual Studio Online, or from Bitbucket if you're a Mercurial user, and makes it really easy for you to effectively deploy an app and run it. And we're going to see a demo of that in just a second. What's cool, though, is all the other things it does as well. So how many people have ever wanted to scale their app across multiple virtual machines? A few people. You know, and if you haven't, hey, if your site's slow, you might want to. And so one of the things that's built in is something we call auto-scale support. And so we'll walk through this in a demo in just a second as well. And what this basically allows you to do is you can say, hey, when my site traffic really gets warm, when my virtual machines are starting to get overloaded, automatically scale out my app across multiple virtual machines. And you can say, I want to do 3. You can say, I want to do 100. And you can basically have us dynamically scale up and scale down the capacity based on what you need. The great thing is when you scale it out, you get great performance. What's nice is you can also set up a rule so that we'll automatically scale down as your load drops as well, which basically allows you to save money. So you can effectively tailor the resources you have based on only what you need. We have a cool feature we call staging support. We've actually genericized it recently to kind of call it even deployment slots, which means you can have any number of these things in action. How many people have ever deployed an app and then realized, oh boy, I just made a mistake, and I've just taken down the site? Great. How many people have ever deployed an app and then had the network conk out on them halfway during the deployment and realized that they updated half the app but not the other half of the app, and the app is now broken? Yeah. How many people have ever wanted to privately test an application with some percentage of their users before you flip it to the other 99% of people? Okay. All those things you can do today, but they're a lot of work. And the nice thing about the website service is it takes a lot of that work away from you. You can create any number of what are called staging slots now on the Azure website service. You effectively say, hey, this is my production site. Say, this is my staging site. And what you can now do is when you deploy code, you can choose which of those slots to deploy the code to. And then you can dynamically flip what is the primary or the secondary version of your site dynamically with just a REST call. And so literally in 2 or 3 seconds, all your traffic can now go to your new deployed site. You can always hit a private URL for any of your staging slots. So in other words, a common scenario would be deploy to a staging slot, do the final test on it, and then swap into production for it to go live. What's great is if you have a problem, you can swap back to the old version and not have any downtime as you do it. We also have a cool feature we just went live with staging slots. Which also now allow you to say, rather than do a hard swap of every user to one or the other, let's set it up so that I only do 1% of traffic to the new version, 99% of traffic to the old version, and you can actually do a comparison on performance, other type of real-time metrics around how people are using your site, and then once you're confident, you can say, increase it to 20%, and then 100%, and have all the traffic go to the new site. So that's another way you can effectively do rolling updates, test in production as you do it, and then basically only send all your traffic over once you're fully confident that that's going to work. We have a cool feature called web jobs. Anyone here ever wanted to run like a background task on their website? Yeah, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. You can spin off threads, which cause their own unique set of challenges when you do it. You can try to command line out to a command line process, or you can have a separate VM do things. One of the cool things about the website service is it has a really nifty model we call web jobs, where you can basically create a command line exe, or it could be a batch script, or a PowerShell script, or a Node.js script. And you can basically run this thing as a job in the background on the same virtual machines that are hosting your website. They're in isolated containers, so you don't have to worry about them interfering with things. And basically, this allows you, for example, if say someone places an order on a website, you can write to, say, a queue, as an example, and say, this is work I'd like someone to do at a future point, and then respond back to the customer immediately saying, done, your order was placed. And then effectively, you could have one of these web jobs written in whatever language you want, pull the item off the queue, process it, and then actually do the work in the background without blocking the UI thread or actually even running inside the web server itself. And the benefit there is it gives you a much more interactive site. It gives you a much easier way to scale out, and you don't have to buy separate VMs or separate infrastructure in order to do it. We also have a cool feature we call Traffic Manager. This lets you take advantage of kind of the multiple region support that Azure has, so that you can actually run your application in multiple places around the world simultaneously. And basically what you can do is you can have a single URL, so you have yourapp.com or yourapp.co.uk, and you can effectively use DNS routing to map different users around the world to different instances of your site. So it's not having to go through a single endpoint. Instead, it's changing the DNS rules, and you can set up various policies like location or performance, or you can just sort of randomly select which version you want to send people towards. And so this is a way you can say all your North American users go to a data center in North America, all your Asia customers go to one in Asia, all your Europe customers go to one in Europe. And then you can also set it up rules so that if one of your sites has problems, it can automatically be pulled out of rotation, and even your Europe customers could then be sent to other versions of the site should you choose to. Or if you wanted to make sure the data never leaves Europe or your customers never leave Europe, you could fail over between North Europe and West Europe regions, and they'll always stay inside the EU. So really easy way to set up, improves your performance, gives you great availability. So let's go ahead and see some demos of all this stuff in action. So we got Visual Studio here. Let's go ahead and create first app here using ASP.NET. So we're just going to create the standard ASP.NET app. What would you like to call this app? Silence. Okay, there we go. And so you can see here, I can basically pick whatever template I want. One of the things we've added inside Visual Studio now is this ability, if you have the Azure tools installed, where you can automatically choose if you want to host this app in the cloud. We default to the website service. You can also stick it in a virtual machine. And when you do that, it'll say, what do you want to create it? It turns out no one has taken this site yet. And you can choose wherever you want to run it. So I guess we can run it here. And it's now creating the project. And at the same time as it's creating the project, it's also now going to reach out to Azure and start, you can see it down here, creating a new deployment instance in that West Europe region that's ready now for me to go ahead and deploy. So now it's all downloaded. Silence in the UK is now not deployed yet, but I now have a reserved slot for it. And say, let's just deploy. So we'll right-click and we'll hit publish. We can optimize things, or we can just hit go. And so this is now starting to deploy this standard ASP.NET MVC app to the West Europe region. And so this is doing a one-time, the first deploy, so a lot of the large Entity Framework binaries and other binaries are being copied one time. On subsequent deploys, you'll see it's pretty much instantaneous. We only copy the files that changed. Looks like everything deployed, and then my browser just launched on the other side. We should see in about 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The site's now deployed, and it is in the silence in the uk.azure.websites.net domain. If I wanted to make a change, so for example, let's go to our About box here, your application description page. Let's go ahead and change this. And so we'll say, hello, London. So, build, we'll redeploy, So this is running over here in about 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. there you go. So very simple way, we created an ASP.NET app, published it inside the IDE. It's now live. You can see how easy it is to make a change or customize it. Let's go and look at a few more cool options here. So let's go now into our portal here. Let's browse all our resources. We should see inside here Silence in the UK. It's running. And it's running right now, it looks like, in a free tier. So we can change that in just a second. And you can see I got kind of a simple dashboard view of a lot of different settings inside here. Let's just move this over. It's not, but so you can see a little bit better. If I want to scale this up, I could. So let's see if I can figure out how to do that. And so if I want to, I can go here and I can change my scaling plan. Right now I'm in the, I think, the free tier. So I'm going to change this so I'm running on a set of VMs that have one core. And so this is updating right now. And what I should see in just a minute is my app is now deployed, hopefully soon, in its own isolated set of VMs. There we go. Success. That's always nice to see. I can then also go ahead and go back to my website, click the settings, and you'll notice there's a scale tab. And what I can do is, you'll notice right now it's running on a single VM that we just deployed it. So it's an isolated VM only for my application. One of the things you can do is you can scale up to say, hey, I actually want to run it on two virtual machines instead. So people in the back can't see. There we go. And so you can manually scale up or scale down the number of VMs that you're running. Out of the box, you can scale up to 10 VMs. If you call us, you can scale pretty much to infinity number of VMs. What's cool, though, is rather than manually scale up and scale down, I can also select what's called performance-based. And so rather than kind of have to go in and say add a VM or subtract a VM, I can now, for example, say let's scale between 1 and 5 VMs. So 5 will be the max, 1 will be the least. And let's basically have the scaling be based on performance. And so what I'm going to do is set it up so that my servers always run between 22% and 73% of the CPU on the systems. And basically what that means is if my servers ever, on average, go above 73%, we will keep adding VMs up to 5 so that we have capacity basically to handle that load. And if my CPUs ever go below 22%, we'll start turning off VMs down to 1 in order to save money. And basically all I need to do is click the save button. And this is now going to go ahead, and you can see here it's updating the job. And what you should see here, and there it's green, we basically just changed that job. And so now that website we just created in West Europe, we've scaled out, we have an auto-scaling rule on, and now if we get a ton of traffic hitting it, it'll scale up. And if the traffic dies off, it'll scale down. And I'm only paying for what I'm actually using on a per-minute basis. And we actually do per-minute billing. So if you scale up to 5 for 15 minutes and then scale down to 1 shortly after that, you've only paid for those 5 VMs for 15 minutes total, which is literally just pennies or cents in terms of, or pence in terms of cost. So let's show off a couple other cool features here. So I can turn on kind of monitoring alerts. And you'll see this starting to show up and be populated in a little bit, which is as people hit the site, I'll start to get kind of monitoring data show up here. We also have a cool kind of user analytics capability. If you click on this, I'm going to highlight this, copy and paste it into my VS application. Go to share and layout. What this script basically does is it adds some instrumentation into my site that allow me to get user data. And so now if I go ahead and publish this, again, it's just going to copy the files that changed, so it should be pretty quick. So click, it was instantaneous. And so now I can start hitting the site. A few random pages, boom, 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 just to get a little bit of traffic. I can register, etc. And now let's go back into the management console here. And if I click on this, give it a few seconds, I should see reload this is, oh, something went wrong, great. Good news is that means the data is just about there. But I should see, oh, come on. This is optimized for more production workloads than demo scenarios. But usually, if I wait a minute or so, the data will start to populate inside there. And what we should see, come on. We'll come back to that in just a second and look at it. You'll start to see the data actually show up, and I can get a real-time view of my data. It's sort of populating the engine right now, so that's why it's taking just a few seconds. But hopefully the analytics data is being saved. It will work in a second. In the meantime, let's create one more site. And since there's a few node hands went up, let's actually create a Node.js site. So we're going to create a website using the portal here in this case. You can also do it from a command line. What would you like to call our Node.js site? UK Node.js site. Exciting. So we're going to go ahead and create one here. Let's pick, let's just pick an existing one I already have. And we'll go create it. So this site should take about 10, 15 seconds to show up. So this is just a vanilla site we're creating from scratch. This one we're creating in the US. So again, just to show off, we can deploy it anywhere around the world. And we should see in about 10 or so seconds, this will come back. Come on. There we go. It is there now. And one of the things I have, you go to github.com/skygoo, is Hello World app, which basically just says Hello London in it, in Node.js. And it's in a Hello World demo repository. So what I'm going to go ahead and do here is, on this site we just created, set up continuous deployment from that GitHub repository. And so to do that, I click this. I can basically choose where I want to basically connect to. I'm going to pick GitHub. I could also go to Visual Studio Online. I could do a local Git push, or I could also go to Bitbucket, which is an Atlassian service. And so basically, I'm going to select GitHub. It already knows, because I've already done it once on a different site. It's cached my authorization tokens. I could redo it again if I wanted to. And I can basically choose which repository I want to set up continuous deployment from. We're going to do Hello World. And I can also choose which branch. So if I have multiple branches inside GitHub, I can specify that. I'm going to click OK. And this is now basically setting up continuous deployment to my project. And so this will, again, it's waiting for GitHub to give it the little tickle that says there is a change or a little file. And so you'll typically see this is 15 to 20 seconds. And then it usually shows up. And once it does that, it will automatically deploy my Node.js app into production, and it's automatically set up the change notification so that if I ever check in another change into GitHub, it'll automatically update it. So there you go. It's now deployed it. You can see if you drill in here, you can see that's the actual change itself. And if I go ahead and browse the site, there is the Hello London Node.js app. And so if I want to make a change, let's go ahead here and open up my beautiful Node.js code. What would you like to change it to? Hello London to Blackfriars. like so. We'll save it. Git add, git commit. Say git push origin master. And what this should do is it's just pushed it up into GitHub. GitHub will then reach out to Azure and say, hey, there's a change that just got mated. Hopefully not mated. And we'll see in just a second here, there's the Blackfriars change. It's actually updating the site literally right now with that change. And we should see in just a second is code's live. So that's sort of a simple way you can effectively do continuous deployment, whether it's with Node.js. You can also do that, obviously, with ASP.NET as well, from any source code repository and enable kind of a continuous deployment pipeline as you do it. Common way, you know, common technique people will do is they'll create a staging slot and set up the continuous deployment on the staging slot so that they can always have a continuous way. The developer checks in, it's live, they can hit it with a private URL, and then basically have a human being at the last test, just hit the button before it goes live. Or if you're feeling really bold and you feel confident that all your testing is great, you can also set it up to automatically go live the way I did just here. And so again, very easy to set up. You can basically manage it however you want. Let's go back to that other site we created, the silence one, right? And just see if our analytics is now flowing. Yes, it worked. Good. So you can see here, this is that first site. Took a few, looks like a minute for the analytics to start flowing in. But one of the things you can do, see, hopefully, when I click on this, it's just loading the data again right now, is five people on their iPhones have hit the site. Two on a Windows phone, thank you. and here is the split. We got IE Mobile's 31%. I guess it's the Lumia folks. 25% Safari, we got a couple of Android it looks like, a couple of Firefox, only one Internet Explorer, and I think that was me. You can see we got page views, top five page views. You can see the slowest pages, so if you actually want to see on your site where is the performance slow, if you click this, as the data loads, should. You can add a chart it looks like, but we won't show that now. But you can also see session data show up. I guess the data is still populating as well. But anyway, you can basically see kind of the traffic. It looks like we have 60 page views coming in. And again, you can sort of look at the different data. You can see the peak loads. You can see the percentage totals, what people are doing, et cetera. So pretty easy way. You can add this type of instrumentation to any app. I did it here in my ASP.NET app. We could just as easily add it to our Node.js or PHP apps. In addition to kind of, this is sort of client-side metrics that we've injected, we can also add in server-side agent, and so we can also start measuring, for example, memory or GC, garbage collecting time. If you're a .NET app, you can see stack exception details. All that also can get surfaced through this experience. And so now you can have a single dashboard for the health of your site, both in terms of what the users are experiencing, what types of users are experiencing it. You can see the requests showing up. We'll just minimize this so you can see a little bit more inside here. And any of these things you can drill in so you can see a little bit more. And for a lot of these things, you'll notice there's what's called alerts. And so you can also click add alert on any of these things and set it up so you can say, hey, if I'm starting to see HTTP errors, send me that are greater than a certain threshold within a period of time. So in other words, if I see more than one error in the last 5 minutes, send me an email. And so you can set up an automatic push alert where we'll basically notify you that a problem is occurring, and you can choose whatever metric you basically want to use in order to configure based on it. So that's a little bit in terms of websites in action. A lot more features you can take advantage of, but hopefully it gives you a flavor in terms of some of the productivity you can get if you're doing any type of web-based deployment. We've got some customers, I think the website service itself now is doing something like crazy like 200 billion requests per month. Page views per month, which is, or maybe it's 300 billion, I can't remember, a lot. We're starting to see kind of lots and lots of sites that are doing many, many, many millions of impressions each on top of it. Again, as I mentioned, you can scale up to 10 VMs out of the box. using your standard Azure subscription. If you want to go above that, you can put in a request to increase your quota, and you can effectively scale out to any size deployment that you want. So that's a little bit on web. Let's talk about mobile for a second here. And then we'll get into data, and we'll do a whole bunch more demos, including some new stuff that I guarantee you haven't seen, because I wrote the sample last night, in terms of new capabilities. On the mobile side, very similar to web, we provide a bunch of PaaS services that enable you to build great mobile experiences, ones that work not only with Windows phones, but with iOS and Android as well. And we allow you to basically develop these backends using a variety of languages, including we have great support, obviously, for both .NET, Node.js, and you'll also see it coming for PHP and Java in the near future as well. In the same way, we allow you to deploy your mobile backends to kind of a hosting container service that we provide, lets you scale it out. We allow you to store any type of data on the backend. We'll talk about data in just a second, but you could do NoSQL, you could do relational, you could do MongoDB, you could do a variety of different approaches. We support the ability to do push notifications from your mobile backends, including you can take advantage of a cool service we have called Notification Hubs, which allows you to do what's called broadcast push notifications as well. And basically the idea behind this is, imagine you're building an app and you've got millions of subscribers, and they want to basically, you want to have an engagement system where you can push updates to them on a regular basis. You know, one challenge is if you have a for loop every time you want to send an update, and you basically say, does Joe want to push? Yes. If Fred wants to push? Yes. If Tom wants to push? Yes. You have to write a lot of logic in order to actually handle that as your user base scales, and it's fairly compute intensive in a lot of cases. And so what our Notification Hub service does is it basically allows you to effectively do a publish and subscribe-like broadcast push, where you can set up registrations for any number of users you want using whatever kind of logic or query syntax you want. And so you can say, Fred is interested in these sports teams when he's in London. He's interested in these sports teams when he's in Manchester. And so you can do geofencing. You can do time-based fencing. So you can say, if Fred is on a vacation in Orlando, please don't send the push notification in the middle of the night so it doesn't wake him up. And then basically inside your app, you can send a single REST call, or you can use a strongly typed API, like a .NET API, to basically say, send a notification for people interested in this sports team, and then the service will look to see people like Fred and any other people out there and broadcast the push. And it handles all the differences between the iOS, Apple network that does push notifications, the Android one that Google provides, as well as the Windows one, and allows you to kind of not have to worry about all the mechanic details of how you get that broadcast push down to the client. It's a really powerful service. You can use it with our mobile services backend, or you can just use it from any other VM or backend service you host on Azure. We also, for people that want to do authentication inside their mobile apps, we make it really easy. You can wire up your own authentication, or you can use some of the services we provide that allow you to do single sign-on with social providers, things like Facebook and Google, et cetera. We also now have what's called Azure Active Directory support, which allows you to basically have people log in using their enterprise corporate credentials. And so if you're building a line of business app or you want to target enterprises with a SaaS solution or a mobile solution that allows them to use their own Active Directory credentials, it makes it easy to authenticate. And one of the things that we're doing as part of that is all of our Office 365 APIs, as well as the other services that we're building out, things like Skype and others in the future, we allow you to basically take that same login token that someone might have used for their Active Directory credentials, and if they give you access to it, you can optionally go ahead and access their Office 365 data as well. So again, if you're building an app for a corporate user, whether it's a line of business app you're building yourself, or whether it's a SaaS-based solution that your company is building that you want to sell to enterprises, this makes it really easy. You can integrate with things like calendaring details, contact details, et cetera, and have a nice integrated experience within your mobile app. How many people here have existing APIs that they want to basically mobile enable? No one. No, it's a couple of people. Good. Here's a scenario, which is you've got an existing app on premises, like an SAP system, or you've got an existing trading system or any other type of app inside your corporate environment, or you're building a cloud-based service and you're exposing a REST web API through that, and you say, hey, I want to be able to have a mobile app connect to it. It might be a mobile app in another department, it might be a mobile app within your team, or it might be a mobile app that you want to enable another partner to be able to connect to or build and actually connect to your service. And One of the things that we often find when we talk to developers is they say, okay, I want to be able to take these developers building these mobile apps, have them call my API, but I'm worried, you know, will it be secure? How do I get good analytics on how they're using the API? How do I secure it? How can I do quotas so that one, you know, popular app can't completely kill and hammer my API? And how can I actually bill someone for this API if it becomes super popular, or if I want to enable a business model that allows me to charge for API access? So one of the services that we've launched recently, we're pretty excited about, is something called the Azure API Management Service. This is another cool mobile capability. And what it basically allows you to do is create a proxy API in the cloud. So your API could either be hosted in our cloud, it could be hosted in Amazon, it could be hosted inside your own firewall, inside your on-premises environment. And what you do is you create a proxy API where you go ahead and you register your existing private API. We then provide a public API, and you can give it whatever DNS name you want. And then anytime someone calls the proxy, we'll in turn go ahead and call your API through our proxy. And that lets you, for example, set up ACLs so that only our proxy can call you. And it basically means that no one has direct access to your API unless, you know, you privately give them an endpoint to it as well. What's cool then is a developer can go to a developer portal that we also enable you to optionally expose, where they can learn about how to call your API, they can test your API. The portal can give out access tokens to the API, so if you want to charge for access to the API, you can say, hey, you get a publishing token that you give out, and developer, you're allowed to call this API 100,000 times a month for free, and then you got to pay us if you want to do more. You can set up all those policies through the API management service. And then basically the developer can build that app, whether it's a mobile or web app, call the proxy, and in turn, it'll call the API that you've exposed. And the beauty about this is you now have a way that you can do throttling, you can do quoting, you can do rate limiting so that people can't hammer your API and bring you down. You can set up business policies as you do it, and you can also choose what access control or security policy you want to do in order to actually authenticate and authorize access to it. So you could give out a token, you could do Azure AD if you want to do kind of a corporate credential, or you could set up any custom OAuth or SAML token passing as well. And then what's nice is that publisher portal will also give you real-time analytics. So in the same way you saw with the mobile or the web demo, I can show you how many sessions that people are accessing. You can actually see either in the browser or there's an API, obviously, you can integrate with any backend system, how many mobile apps are calling my API, which app was it, which user was it, how many success versus failures are they getting, what's the latency in terms of the response time of the API. All that's exposed to the portal for you to take advantage of. So a really easy way, you can take any API written in any backend. So this could be, again, this could be a Linux on AWS. It could be inside your firewall running on a legacy system, or it could be hosted inside Azure, and you can now basically publish it for the whole world to see. Again, you can throttle, rate limit, quota web APIs. You get the analytics so you can see who's accessing it, what's the performance like, how often are they doing it. You can secure the APIs through a variety of different mechanisms, including the ability for you to charge. And then one of the features we just went live with, I think, a week or two ago, is what's called multi-region support. And what that lets you do is you can now run your API, for example, in North Europe and West Europe simultaneously. So you can do failover as well as performance load balancing so that people in Western Europe go through one, in North Europe go through the other, and have super fast access throughout it. And again, we provide a built-in developer portal that you can either use or you can customize it and design your own that basically gives you an easy way you can connect up to your developers. So cool feature to take advantage of. How many people have used the API management service? Cool. How many people are going to check it out now? Good. Success. Cool. Let's switch gears now and talk about data. This is a place where we've spent a lot of time in the last year and I think made a lot of progress on in terms of bringing out a whole bunch of new capabilities to take advantage of in Azure. And I think a lot of people that have been on Azure for a while kind of know our old-style data capabilities and don't have full exposure to a lot of the new ones that are now available. And that's what we're going to spend the next 20 minutes or so walking through, including a bunch of cool services that my guess is the majority of the room has never seen before or never used. So traditionally, in fact, this time last year, we basically had two services in production, a SQL database service, which basically provided a database as a service that's a relational database, and then a service called HD Insight, which provided a managed Hadoop offering. And what we've done kind of over the last year is enhance both of those significantly, and I'll talk about more how in just a little bit. We're also have introduced a new NoSQL database option called DocumentDB. That gives you kind of now a broad way, whether it's JSON documents, whether it's relational data, or whether it's kind of unstructured data inside a Hadoop model that you can now use to store any amount of data. We've also then added a bunch of higher level services, ones like search. So if you want to provide a search capability on top of any type of data, we now have search as a service. It internally uses Elasticsearch, but provides a whole bunch of additional features on top of it and makes it really easy to host in the cloud. We have a service called Data Factory that allows you to orchestrate movement of data between systems. So say, for example, you've got operational data inside SQL or DocDB. You can set it up so you automatically every night move it into Hadoop, or move it every 5 minutes, or move it on change. Or if you've got on-premises data inside an on-premises system, you can automatically move it to the cloud to do analytics on top of it. We also then have a new service we call Event Hub, which basically allows you to do streaming ingestion of messages, like IoT data, or you can also pull in data from, say, a browser or mobile app if you want to do real-time analytics or streaming on top of it. And then on top of that, we've got a whole bunch of new capabilities that allow you to reason on top of data, including a new machine learning service that allows you to do predictive analytics and use things like R and Python, as well as a whole bunch of libraries of machine learning modules, so you can look for sort of abnormal changes in your data or unique insights in the data. We also have a service called Stream Analytics, which allows you to take events from, say, Event Hub or any other source and basically do real-time analysis on top of that data, so you can also do kind of temporal analysis on top of incoming streams of vast amounts of data. And then we have a new BI service we call Power BI, which provides a nice way you can visualize data and you can mix and match data up in order to do kind of a, provide kind of a business intelligence solution on top of all this. So a lot more capabilities for you to take advantage of and some cool things you can do. So let's quickly blitz through most of those services and show off a bunch of demos of each of them. So our SQL database service is one of our older database services that we had, or one of our oldest services that we've had inside Azure. And it basically provides a way you can store and run a relational database in the cloud. We've done a bunch of updates to it over the last year, which makes it a lot more powerful. We've increased the size of the database to 500 gigabytes. You'll see that size increase even more going forward. And we've also now provide a 4.9s SLA on top of that database, which in the cloud world is a very high SLA. That you can actually run on it. We also have something called Elastic Scale, which allows you to take multiple databases, shard them together, and basically get petabytes of storage if you want to. A couple of cool things about our database service. You saw me at the very beginning create one of these SQL databases, is it's a managed service. So I can basically stand it up with just a REST call and I can tear it down. You know, I think we do something like crazy, like 290,000 databases are created every single day on Azure. A lot of them are short-lived databases that are getting torn down. But that gives you kind of the sense of what you can do with these databases from an operations perspective, is you can stand them up, throw them away, do whatever you want with them as you do it. All of them provide built-in backup, and they also provide this cool self-service restore capability, which if you're a developer that's ever worked on data, you usually will come to appreciate. Basically, the way this works is not only is it backed up, but it's backed up on a per-time basis. So if anyone ever written a code like this, where you say delete from this, and you realize you forgot the where clause, I've done that. And that's when you find out whether backup, you know, not only did you back it up, but can you restore? Which usually is the bigger problem with backups. The nice thing about the self-service capability that's built into the service is not only do we have backups, but we also have what are called time-based log replays. You can go up to 30 days of backups, and you can effectively create a new database off of any point in time transaction in your entire last month. Depends on the size of the database. I think everything gets at least a week, and then the premium ones are up to a month. And so you can basically say at 2:39 on last Thursday, right before I wrote the code that started causing errors inside the data model, create a new database based on that time slot, and we will automatically do it for you. We also have this cool feature called Active Geo-Replication. This lets you take advantage of the multi-region capability of Azure so that you can run your primary database, for example, in North Europe, and then you can have a secondary database in West Europe, and you can set it up so that as changes happen in your primary, it's automatically being replicated in real time to your secondary. And then if you have a problem, for example, in that primary, you can automatically fail over your application to the secondary and go ahead and use it. What's nice also is you get always read-only support on all your secondaries. So, for example, you might just run your reporting apps on that secondary so you can still take advantage of the compute there. And then, again, in a DR situation, you just send a single REST call, it fails over, and then that becomes your primary that you can then run your application traffic off of. Anyone here ever set up DR for SQL? How easy or hard is it to set up DR off-site for a SQL box?
Hard.
Hard, yeah. How long did it take you?
A couple days a week.
A lot of companies measure this in quarters in terms of how long it takes. Cool thing about Azure now is it's really easy to do. So let's go ahead and set it up. So we're going to go back into our portal, switch to which account? This one? I have my personal account, and I also have the account where when I want to replicate SQL box in 7 locations around the world, I charge it to someone else. So let's go ahead and set up GeoDR. So we're going to go ahead and browse to one of these databases. Let's see. I think it's this one. And so basically, I've got here, SQL database running, I think, in North Central U.S. right now, and our North Central region. And what I'm going to basically do is I want to make sure this thing's replicated around the world. So we're going to click on Configure Geo-Replication. And you can see here, here's a whole bunch of data center regions that I can basically clone this database in real time, too. And so the first region we're going to go to is, let's say, South Central U.S. And I can basically choose that server, hit create. And what this is basically doing is, in just a few seconds, configuring it so that, and you'll see a dotted line, it is now copying that SQL database to the other regions. That database we created earlier in the day, I can basically now just go ahead and say, copy it into the South Central region. Let's expand into Europe. Would you like to go let's go West Europe. So let's say I want to have this be a truly global application. Let's copy it into West Europe. Create, and again, and we should see in a matter of seconds, the dotted line up here, that database is now also having DR inside Europe. So if a meteor takes out all the North America, good news is our data is still there, or is still available. We might not be, but our data is. And then just in case it wipes out you too, we'll go and replicate it in Japan. And so we're going to pick the Osaka region where I already have a server. Create, and what you're going to see now is we're also now replicating Japan. So we could keep doing this forever, but effectively what we've done here is started out geo-replication. We're creating 3 more copies of our database in any region around the world. All of the traffic is going off of the Microsoft Fiber backbone, so you're not paying any bandwidth charges as you're doing it. And you're basically, the data is never going across the public internet as you're doing it. You can see we've now completed with the replication in Europe. That's why the dotted line just got a little bit less dotty. And we should start seeing the other regions show up also in the next sort of 30 seconds or so in terms of complete. And once we do that now, every time we make a change to our primary database, the change will be automatically replicated in those 3 other locations, all of which have read-only access, so we can still do reporting apps, we can do BI apps off of those secondaries, we could have our web apps and mobile apps use them if they're in Europe to get even faster response time, and then I can basically go into the management portal and fail over and change whatever is the primary versus the secondary with a simple REST call that takes effect pretty much immediately. So that's literally how easy it is in order to actually go ahead and stand up these types of environments. You can see they're all starting to blink because they're starting to come online. And, you know, once you're done, that's how easy it is to basically set up GeoDR. So, pretty powerful way you can set it up, take advantage of all these capabilities. Other capabilities we've added to SQL DB in the last sort of 6 months or so, better management of large databases. This was kind of a weak point that SQL DBs had for a while, which is if you had like lots of data and you wanted to do like change scripts, we had a limit where you could only change up to 2 gigabytes or write a change transaction log of up to two gigabytes in size. And so that was kind of a pain point people had to work around. We now have, I think, unlimited change size that you can now apply on your database, so it makes it much easier to handle large databases. Up to 100x performance improvements, including adding columnar, in-memory columnar store. And you'll see the Hecaton in-memory OLTP operations also show up in the next couple months. We've expanded the surface area for SQL databases so that a lot of the traditional on-premise SQL Server APIs, things like SQL CLR, T-SQL Windows calls, XML index, change tracking, they're all now supported. We've improved monitoring and troubleshooting support, so if you use X events and DMVs, which I don't know anything about, but if you're a DBA, you probably do, you can now use those to manage and monitor your SQL database. And then we've added a bunch of new security capabilities that you can leverage, things like auditing support, so you can see any changes that occur. Row-level security, so you can provide access to individual rows within the database to different users based on whatever security policy you set. Data masking support, this is really cool if you're storing credit card information or even emails. You can set up rules so that only certain accounts or certain users can get access to that data. And so think of the scenario if you say select star from orders or select star from customers and private customer data ends up getting returned, you can inadvertently cause a SQL bug that exposes information in a bad way. And so with data masking, you can say if the web server requests select star from customers, that credit card data is automatically masked out with a fake value. So it still comes back in the right schema shape, but basically there's no private data. And then you could say only the credit card payment system app, which runs on a separate account, is allowed to basically have access to it. It's a pretty cool feature, and in this day and age where information disclosure is happening a lot, a great one to take advantage of that can really protect you. And very soon you'll see us light up what's called TDE encryption, which provides full encryption at rest, and will also support the ability for you to provide your own key and actually store it inside our Key Vault service, which is HSM-backed, which means that we never have access to your security key, so that even if someone wanted us to give you your data, we don't have access to the unencrypted data. We can't give it to it. We can give you the encrypted, but they can't actually access it. And so that's another thing, if you're in a compliant or heavily regulated industry and you want complete control over access to your data, you can basically take advantage of those features. So a lot of cool stuff you can leverage. What's cool is there's other data sources you can now use as well, including our DocumentDB service. Anyone here use DocumentDB? A few people have. This has basically been designed, built, and optimized for storing JSON documents. And you can pretty much store any size or any number of documents. And I'll talk about some of the performance characteristics in just a bit. What's nice is that it allows you to store these JSON documents in a schema-free way. This means you don't have to define a schema up front. You literally can just sort of save these JSON documents using whatever schema you want. And then you can effectively write SQL statements against these documents, and we automatically index them and basically provide you a fast query engine on top of them. You can do multi-document transactions with them. It's highly tuned in performance, and it's really designed kind of for a cloud footprint. I'll give you an example of how we're using it ourselves at Microsoft. The MSN service now uses DocumentDB for all of its unique user data. It has about 425 million users in it. They store over 20 terabytes of JSON documents. And you know, we basically use it to process billions of requests per day. And it's under 15 millisecond writes and single-digit millisecond reads of that data access. So it's very fast, very performant. And the nice thing about being NoSQL is you're not, you know, we basically can scale out very easily, and you know, you're not limited to a single kind of table or transaction size that you have to accommodate for. Another cool service, and we're going to see a demo of DocDB and Search in Action, is the Search service. How many people here are using the Search service? Cool. Well, it's not very cool, but it's cool for the demo purpose, that only two people have used it. How many people have ever incorporated Search into an app? Cool. How many other people have ever wanted to incorporate Search into an app? Cool. How many people here thought they were coming to see Peter Pan? Okay, and they're like, oh, who the hell is JSON? So the cool thing about our Search service is if you have lots of content, or even if you have a little bit amount of content, You probably want to be able to provide a search service inside your application, whether it's online retail, e-commerce, user-generated, et cetera. And the search service makes it really easy to do it. And so whether it's sort of, you want to search for restaurants and you see ratings, or you want to search for movies, or you want to basically search on BI data, there's literally a limitless number of scenarios for how you probably want to be able to incorporate search into your app. Creating search experiences, though, are pretty hard, especially in the cloud. There's not a lot of great infrastructure out there that's super cloud-friendly in terms of providing search services. And so typically people that are standing up search, whether it's Solr, Lucene, Elasticsearch, spend a lot of time managing the infrastructure and having to tune the search experiences to get it right. And what the Azure Search Service does is it basically enables you to easily incorporate great search experiences without having to manage the infrastructure or become search experts. Basically what you do is you go into Azure, you provision a search service. You can then go ahead and create an index, which is basically whatever schema you want for that search. You can then push in data into that index. And so the nice thing about this is it's not limited to only going in SQL or going in StockDB. We're actually going to have built-in adapters that make it easy to pull data from there. But if you have any data literally on any storage system in the planet, you can effectively call us and index the data inside our search service. In fact, even if your data is stored on-premises, but you want to provide a search experience in the cloud, you can actually run the search service in the cloud even if the underlying data is stored on-premises or even an Amazon-based VM, and you can still provide a search experience on top of it. So it provides a nice decoupling of it. You can then write search queries against it, and then you can optionally tune the results. What's nice about the search API is we provide a whole bunch of capabilities that you can leverage, and it's just a standard REST API today. And then we're going to build kind of language-specific APIs on top, so you can call it from any type of service. It gives you kind of the standard full-text search capabilities, so you can search on a particular word. But what's nice is it lets you do strict filters, sorting, paging, field selection. You can do faceting support, which I have to confess I didn't know what faceting support was until I prepared this talk. But it basically allows you to create, think of it as like subqueries within search. So if you have like an e-commerce site and you want to say search for products within this price range, you can make sure that you only show that option if you actually have products in that price range. Hit highlighting support and a variety of other style scenarios. So some examples. If I want to do a simple search, I can just sort of set a search equals my search term. If I want to make strict, I can say, hey, search for Ridge, but filter it only if it has a class called Trail. I could do sorting, order by, selection, also as part of the API. I can do the facet, so I can say, hey, if it's a rating by country. Geospatial is kind of a cool one, where I can basically say only search for things if they're within a certain location. So if you're thinking about a restaurant or what's nearby, you can effectively incorporate that type of experience using search and basically use the user's location to see results based on that type of index. And you can even do advanced geospatial, where you can actually create a polygon, so you can say only if you're in, say, the city of London, that particular location, or within Blackfriars, and you can define whatever point is and actually have it be as precise as your geolocation is, data is, or not. So let's see a simple example of this in action. So, let me, so this is a really beautiful search experience, but will let us still show off a couple features, even though it's not very pretty. And let me see here. So basically, this is sort of simple standard ASP.NET MVC to-do app, and I've got a bunch of things here, items here. And what you can see here is I have a simple search text box. And just to illustrate, a couple features here, notice if I type P, I can actually auto-complete search terms. So that's something that the Search API allows you to kind of easily build an experience. If I want to do like P star, I can actually do fuzzy search. So I can see anything that has P followed by something. If I wanted to, for example, say, hey, I want to search on things that are meat plus lunch, I can do combination searches and filter based on anything that has meat or lunch in the terms. I can basically do kind of any type of search capability that I wanted to as part of this. What's nice is the way I actually build this is pretty easy. What am I looking at here? I basically wrote this using DocDB, so it's pulling the data out of DocDB, and so I'm just doing kind of standard search terms against DocDB. And then the actual item search repository here, you can see it's basically just calling this sort of suggest name, suggest your name, so forth, and it's making a standard REST call using HTTP APIs in order to query the service and get back results. So you can call, you know, a variety of different terms. You can see here's how I've actually created the index, and these are the particular properties that I added in the search service for the index. The entire sample, I'll post the sample after the talk, you know, is not a tremendous amount of code. And then once you basically do this, I can effectively add this sort of search experience on top of this DocDB. It could just as equally be a SQL database. It could just as equally be a MySQL database. And because the search is running outside of the database, I don't have to worry about lots of search terms also bringing down my database system or hammering my existing web server. It's basically running as a separate service that I can go ahead and run against. What's nice, though, is not only does it provide basic searching, and by default, this default search scoring is based on just text relevance, but you can also define what are called custom scoring rules for even more custom tuning as well. And so how many people here built a search experience with custom scoring terms before? A few people have. A lot of people are like, oh, that sounds interesting. A scenario would be here, let's say you have, certain fields are more important than others, or you have a recommendation service, you want to weight certain people's views higher than others. In other words, people that have 5-star ratings go to the top of the search result, regardless of what the text relevance says. You can basically use a variety of different mechanisms to create your own custom scoring profiles for different scenarios, and it's pretty easy to do it. And so you can basically give us what's called a scoring function for how we should weight certain fields or certain relevance. You can basically do magnitude, you can do freshness, you can do distance. You can basically use whatever kind of logic you want in order to actually boost the rating. So in other words, if someone searches for a coffee shop and there's one that is, a 5-minute walk away, again, you might want to rank that one higher based on the geolocation, or you might want to rate it higher based on they paid you money, so they get rated higher, or you might want to rate it on, customer ratings based on the experience. Again, you can control all this. It's a very easy way. You can specify it as part of your indexing strategy, and then you can use it to dramatically boost the results of your service. And again, the great thing is you can literally stand up a search experience in like less than a day for any app, whether it's mobile, or it's web, or anything else. And again, the data can live in any source, and it can literally live on any cloud or any on-premise system, and you can basically stand it up and start to use it. Anyone here going to check out the search service now? Cool. It's a cool service it's in preview still today, but you'll see us go into GA in the next couple weeks. And one of the big bits of feedback I did give the team is, hey, you're getting started docs. Keep working on those. Because it's a powerful service that if you watch the videos, you can figure out how to use. You'll see even better tutorials show up in the next couple weeks, because it's something I think pretty much anyone that's building a web or mobile app should take advantage of. What's cool about the search service as well is there's a free tier. So there's no reason not to take advantage of it as well. So even if you've got like a personal blog or you've got a personal website or a small volume website, you can stand up a free tier of the search service and start to incorporate it and take advantage of it within your system. Let's talk about IoT. Anyone here doing real-time streaming or IoT-related information? Okay, number of people. How many people think that sounds cool but have no idea where to start? Okay, a few others. Cool thing is, within Azure, we've got a couple services now you can take advantage of. And in particular, this Event Hub service and the Stream Analytics service is a cool service you want to look at. Event Hub is in GA today. Stream Analytics will go GA in a few weeks. Basically, what it lets you do with Event Hub is you can now ingest literally millions of messages per second to Azure. So Event Hubs can store, each Event Hub can handle up to 10 million messages per second, or events per second. And then you can use the Event Hub to dump it into any kind of stream processing system you want to. So you can just save it to disk and blob storage, or you can run it through something called Stream Analytics or Storm on top of Hadoop if you wanted to use that instead, and basically use it to do kind of any type of analysis on top of that data. And then you can store that data, for example, inside a database, a NoSQL store, blob storage, et cetera. So a really powerful way that you can actually look at data in real time. And what I thought I'd do, this is the most complex, riskiest demo of all. It's not that complex, and it's not that risky, but he says. But hopefully it'll work. So what I'm going to do here is I got a little IoT sensor here, and it's about, I think, 12 pounds or 15 pounds that you could buy. It's from TI, but you can imagine any other ones out here. And it's Bluetooth enabled, and it basically checks humidity and temperature. And what I've done is I paired it with my PC. And so any data based on this will flow through Bluetooth through my PC, although it could be any other type of system as well. It doesn't have to be a Windows PC or even a computer. And then I basically just, right now on my PC, have a little application here that hopefully, yes, good, it found. And it now has just paired up with this Bluetooth. And what I'm going to do here is just hit start, which is going to start taking on my PC and send it to our Event Hub service running inside Azure, which you'll notice in the background now is processing this data in real time. And you can see here on this dashboard, which is based with Power BI, which is our new BI service, although you can obviously visualize it however you want, you can now see average temperature and humidity ratings. So if I breathe onto this, you should see temperature is going up, humidity is going up, going way up. Yeah, and so you can see, somewhere about it. Yeah. What's cool is this is really easy to do. And so if I go here and I go here and I type this, which I should have done before I started, let's see how this is actually running. So I'm going to load the old Azure Management Portal tool here. And what you'll see in just a second. So you can see the events still coming in here. This is loading. The inner tubes are slow. Good. And so there is an Event Hub service that I've wired up where I'm basically collecting the events. And then what's cool here is I also now have a stream analytics service, which is right here. And I've got a Bluetooth sensor, which is active. And so I can see kind of like a dashboard of stuff. And so this basically is looking at all the incoming data, which is just simple JSON messages coming in over HTTP. And one of the cool things is I can pull it from any source. And so this is pulling it from what's called an event hub, which is the actual listener. Running inside Azure, and then Stream Analytics is basically processing the data as it's coming in real time. And what's cool is with Stream Analytics, I can do a couple things with it. I can just take all of the data and save it, but the downside is if I have lots of sensors or I have lots of data points, I might not want to save every single message as it's coming in. What I might want to save is just what's called a tumbling window. And so what you can do with Stream Analytics, which is pretty cool, if I can make it move back here so you can see it, is I can now write just a standard select statement on top of the incoming stream of data. And I'm basically taking the max temperature and max humidity and recording it. And you'll notice here I'm grouping it by what's called a tumbling window. So I'm saying in a given second, look at the aggregate values and only save the aggregate within that second. So if I have an off reading, I can automatically discard it, and I can also make sure that if I'm recording thousands of messages per second, I'm not filling up thousands of rows of database. I can basically write one record per second. You can change it to be whatever you want, every 5 seconds, every 10 seconds. Whatever you want, you can change it. And you can effectively take any incoming JSON schema, and you can convert it into whatever schema you want to, and then you can dump it onto your next system later on in the cycle. And so you can see right now on the output front, I am saving it into Power BI, which is my dashboard, and that's how Power BI is, oops, when I go ahead and run this, basically updating this in real time. It has a listener on Stream Analytics and Event Hub, and it can effectively display and visualize any type of data that's being thrown out. It can also pull data from a SQL database and others, but the beauty about this system right now is I'm not actually even having to store it in a SQL database or a NoSQL system. I could, but I'm also now just directly passing it on to another in-memory system so it can be super fast and super scalable. So really easy service to take advantage of. Literally in a matter of minutes, you can stand up your own IoT system and do whatever you want with it. So storing data and looking at it in kind of a, you know, compute way is interesting, but there's a whole bunch of things you can't actually glean, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of additional information you can glean off of your incoming data that you can probably get insights from. And that's where this next service that we just went GA with last week comes into play, which is the Azure Machine Learning Service. How many people here are using Azure Machine Learning? A few people are. How many people have ever heard of machine learning? It's cool. It's scary. The stuff you can do with machine learning is truly awesome. And it's a little freaky from a privacy perspective, depending on what you do with the data. But the cool thing is you can control what you can do with the data, and we've got a cool service that lets you actually do it. What's nice about our machine learning service is it basically lets you stand up what's called predictive analytics APIs on top of your data. And it can be any type of data. So it could be SQL, it could be NoSQL, it could be IoT, it could be Hadoop. And we basically, the promise we give is you can take your data, you can create a predictive model, and you can create what's called an operational web API on top of that model in minutes, which is a big differentiator from other machine learning services, which are tend to be pretty hard to do. And basically, we let you, again, take data from anything. So it could be blobs, tables, it could even be S3 inside Amazon. You can basically use our ML Studio to create a machine learning model from it. You can then stand up an API based on your model that any app that you write can call. And if you want to, you can even stick it in our API marketplace so you can sell the API to others to use. And then you can basically use it from any application you want. So let's see sort of a generic example, and then let's add machine learning to our IoT sensor in just a second. So let's go back here and go to azure.com. And if you check out analytics, you can see our machine learning service. If you hit starting now, it'll take you into our kind of our online Azure Studio. This is loading here. And this basically, so let's go here first. Basically, one of the things we have here that's kind of cool, because a lot of people don't really know machine learning, is we have a gallery of existing experiments and machine learning operations that other people have built. So, for example, if you want to predict if someone's going to die, you could use this cool one, which allows you, it actually is sort of a Titanic passenger list by default. You could substitute your own passenger list if you'd like. And it basically has a survivor prediction model, if you want to be morbid. So we take this list of people that came here today, and we could run it through, and I could predict when you're going to die. Better yet, we could go to the pub, and you could actually predict the wine quality, or we need a beer one, of what it looks like, Twitter sentiment analysis, flight delay predictions. You know, you can basically predict predictive maintenance. So if you have hardware equipment, or if you want to be able to predict when will this elevator break down, you know, you can basically use that. So any of these models you can basically start with. And so the cool thing about this is if you want to start, you go here, you can learn about this prediction. You click open in the studio, and we'll basically open this up in our machine learning studio. You hit yes. And then basically we have an ML designer that we provide for you. And you'll see this show up in just a second. And this basically is loading your machine learning model. And assuming my inner tubes come back, I think because I'm streaming vast amounts of data right now, I'm clogging up the internet, so it's a little bit slower. But you should see here now, machine learning model. I can zoom in. And you can see for this particular one, for example, you start with the Titanic data set of passengers, and you basically run it through a streaming system where you're basically removing a couple of the columns, you're inserting data, you're doing called missing value scrubber. So if you're missing a value, it actually will automatically calculate what's a good substitute, so you can still continue. You can split the data, you can do a two-class decision forest or a two-class boosted decision tree, neither of which I understand. And eventually evaluate the model. And so at the end result, you hit run or you hit prepare web service, and this gives you an API that you can now call within any application to say, hey, here's a user, give me back a score between 0 and 1 of their likelihood of dying on the Titanic. And so this thing uses things like, you know, were their family members, did they survive? Were they male? Were they female? There's a bunch of kind of analytics that they've looked at. What's nice is it's not a if-else statement here. You're actually training on the data itself. So if it finds, hey, there's people with a certain last name, they were more likely to survive or there's not, you don't have to know that. You can actually reason on top of the data. And so if you've got a bunch of data sets, customer lists, product lists, returns on inventory, financial predictions, you can actually build a model, create an API, and then integrate it inside your app. Let's take a look at how we can use this with our nifty little tool here. Let me stop and start this up again. And we'll go here to here. And hopefully this data is coming back. So you'll notice here, breathe on it again. Humidity, come back. Let's go in here, maybe just stop and start this little dude. Sensor went to sleep. Oh, my sensor might have died. This is a non-Azure sensor, by the way, so I do not. Occasionally it gets disconnected from the pairing of the sensor, but I can in the interest of time, I won't make you watch me delete and reattach my Bluetooth device. But what I do want to show here is you'll notice in the bottom here, and it might be hard to see in the back, so I apologize, but it basically, you'll notice it's a temperature anomaly detected by machine learning service. So what we were doing is we were streaming in that data, and you can see these results showing up in real time as I started breathing on the device, is it fired an alert that said something abnormal just happened with this sensor. And abnormal wasn't a hard-coded rule that said when it goes to the temperature above 30 degrees, fire. It was abnormal based on the other data it had seen over the last couple hours. And so it trained itself on what is normal and unnormal experiences. And basically what we've done is we simply were running all the data not only to Power BI, but also to the machine learning API, checking each data point to say, you know, both was this normal or not, but then also using each data point to learn and train the model for future endpoints to look at. And then when it said, hey, this is an abnormal change, it fired an alert. And again, the cool thing about this is it's not something the developer had to hard code in a bunch of rules and business logic. Instead, you took the real data, you trained a model, and then you can basically use this machine learning API however you want. And so this gives you a much more accurate, much more predictable way that you can actually go ahead and detect whether something is reason or not. And there's literally a million use cases you can use this inside applications. If you've got an app where you have customers or you have any database you have customers, you can use this to predict which are your high-value customers, which customers are likely to churn or cancel your service in a really easy way. If you've got people browsing your website looking at products, you can actually say, hey, these are the other products people like you are likely to buy and actually show a nice list. And with machine learning, you can get a much more predictive list than hard-coding that into some sort of business rules. So anyway, cool service to take advantage of. It's now general availability, and we're seeing some really interesting use cases of it. That you can take advantage of. Last but not least, data service I'm just going to briefly mention is our Hadoop as a service called HD Insight. It's 100% open source Apache Hadoop. It's based on the latest Hadoop, which is version 2.6. We just updated it about 2 weeks ago. It lets you deploy clusters in minutes and scale dynamically. And the scale dynamically part is a cool new feature we just added. Previously, you had to tear down a cluster and recreate it if you wanted to change the node size or the individual number of nodes inside your cluster. You can now do that entirely dynamically just using a REST call. We also now support both Windows and Linux containers, Windex. And so you can basically, the host operating system that's running your Hadoop, previously it was only Windows, now we support Linux as well. We support SSH, we support all the standard things. You write your Hadoop commands both in .NET and Java code, and we now support HBase, Storm, Hive, Arse, that should be Stinger, not Stringer, adding Spark soon. It basically allows you to run any kind of high-level standard Hadoop workload that you want. using Azure. Bunch of cool systems, and I think we're going to talk about one of them actually during the break, so I won't go into too much details here. But you know, folks are using the combination of these types of big data systems to do things like, you know, predictive maintenance around gas machines and other infrastructure. We're going to have, I think, they're here. Coming up and talk about their solution. And I hope this slide has some comparison to what you actually did, but someone sent me this slide, so. But it was from my team, so I'm not sure if this is an old one or not. But you can see kind of the topology, and I think they're going to go into more details about how they're using it. But anyway, lots of data services to take advantage of, lots of cool things to use. Let me do 5 more minutes, then I promise I'm out of here. I'm getting the blinking light. It's a little late. Lots of services. I've only touched the surface in terms of the types of PaaS services you can use. We talked a little about IaaS. What I'm going to do is just spend a few minutes talking about management and some of the work that we're doing around Azure to make it easy to manage all these services together and some of the powerful things you can now do with them. One of the things that we've been working on, when we first launched Azure, and really until the last year or last 9 or 10 months, with Azure, you managed everything as like an individual resource. You create a database, you create a VM, you create a website. In fact, most of the demos I've shown so far here are sort of like that still, where you kind of manage them independently and then they talk to each other. One of the things that we just come out with in the last year, and it's just went GA earlier this calendar year, is something we call resource groups, which is a way that you can now bundle multiple resources together into a single kind of application or group concept that allows you to basically manage the entire group of resources together. And what's nice is you can stick any type of resources in here. So you could have a VM, you could have a website, you could have a SQL database and stitch them all together. And then you can basically have a single lifecycle management. So you can tear them down and create them as a single entity all in one. You can also apply security and role-based access control at the resource level as well. As part of the resource group concept, we then also came out with this declarative JSON file format that allows you to declaratively specify the relationship between resources inside your resource group and allow you to stitch up and wire up different resources together. So for example, I could have a resource group called My App, or Your App, or wherever you want to name it. You could have a SQL database, a website, and a VM. So you have both PaaS and IaaS. And you could basically say, this thing depends on SQL, this thing depends on the VM, and you can basically pass around the configuration between the nodes, and you can basically just say, deploy my app as a single thing, or tear down my app as a single thing, or give me the operations on my app as a single thing, and manage it as sort of an entire application. This ends up being a super powerful way that you can script out and manage all of your resources. Anytime you're doing a non-trivial application that you really look to do. And so just giving you sort of a simple example of this in action, let me do two things. I'm going to run a command here called new Azure resource group. It's a PowerShell command, but you can also do it from our cross-plat CLI. I'm going to create a new resource group called London Demo 121. And I'm basically passing in two files, one which is a meta file location, and the other one is a parameter dev JSON file. And I'm going to say deploy it in the West US. I'm going to hit run on that. And then I'm going to realize, shoot, I need to open up another window so that I can actually show you the files. And so let's go here and here while it's deploying in the background. And open this up. So by the time I've actually, that's some progress. That's not good. But basically what we've done inside this JSON file is basically I can specify whatever parameters I want in a JSON format for any of these operations. So this is a fairly verbose example where I'm basically specifying everything in the world. And you can see basically I can customize this with whatever I want. So I can set the collation size, the max byte size, you know, et cetera, for what my application looks like and the dependencies between them. And then basically I have simple file here where I'm basically just overriding some of the settings, and I can basically hard code, you know, I can basically code in and then override optionally the names for any of these different resources. And so this is a relatively small file. And so I could have, for example, the master file for all my apps, and this could be my dev test version, and I could have a separate production version of a JSON file with just the overrides or however I want. And then effectively I can go ahead and deploy this. We'll see if that worked or not. And when I do, what I should see is I can now go browse all, and I can go now click on the individual resources I deployed, or I could go ahead and look at resource groups. I can see this London Demo 121 group that I just built, and all the different resources within it I can basically drill into and manage as a single entity. And if things fail or I want to roll back, the other nice thing, like it did right now, another nice thing is I can go ahead and just say, remove, yes, and it'll basically tear down that entire entity as kind of a single collection. And so it's an easy way that if I do have a deployment problem, instead of being left in a weird state where I've got lots of different resources that have been created that I now have to write a script to go clean up, I can now actually just literally in a few seconds effectively send the call and tear down that entire resource to get it back to a clean state and then rerun the deployment in order to clean it up and get it healthy. So a nice easy way without ever having to go through the portal to actually do your individual operations that I can now actually use the portal to monitor it and see things, but I can actually use the command line and the sort of scripting APIs in order to kind of deploy everything and manage it as a group however I want to. So pretty easy way I can go ahead and manage multiple resources as a single thing. What's cool is once I deploy this using the management API or using the portal, I can now also see any of the individual operations. And so there's an audit log for everything that I do management-wise as part of this. And so I can actually see the management operations as part of it. I can actually debug wherever that error that I've never seen before occurred. And I can drill in and see, oh, it failed because probably I forgot to clean up the database from last night when I tested it last, and it was a duplicate, or whatever it is. This also gives you a way that you can now see if someone else in your team went in and made a change. And oftentimes you find in a cloud environment, things start breaking. Those things usually start breaking when someone made a change. People always say, I didn't touch anything. You can now actually see, oh yeah, you did. And sort of there's detailed information. There's a cool, what's called correlation ID somewhere in this list here, correlation ID there. And so if you actually want to see, there was a sequence of changes that all occurred at the same time, you can use the correlation ID to understand, hey, someone ran a script at the same time and they had these five things, four of them worked, one of them failed, that was probably the reason it didn't work. We've also added role-based access control into both our management API as well as the portal. This basically now gives you the ability to secure access to any of your resources or any of your groups as a single entity. You can assign it to users, groups, or service principals, and we have built-in roles that make it really easy. In general, I highly recommend don't deploy a production app and give everyone read and write access to it. It sounds sort of simple, but it turns out a lot of people forget to do that. With a role-based access control, you can create what are called role definitions, and you can assign users into those roles. So you could create an owner called Reader that can only read and look at diagnostic information but can't make any changes to the site or see any critical secrets. You could create an owner that can do everything. You could create QA that can do certain things, et cetera. What's nice about the role security model also is you can apply it to any level. So you can set up roles at the subscription level, which basically is sort of the master list. You can create any of those individual resource groups. So you could have app 1, app 2, app 3, and assign roles there. Or even within the individual resources in a resource group, you could say, John, you're allowed to touch the database but not the website, or vice versa. Or you could have read access to the database but no update operations, but you're allowed to actually make modifications to the website. And you can effectively assign it however you want. And the nice thing is it's managed both at the API level, and so you can see this is sort of the REST API that we provide at the management level, and you can see the different granular levels. But we also provide support within the management portal so that if you click on any individual resource, any of these resources, you can actually see this sort of cluster of little people heads. You click on, this will bring up now a permissions tool where you can effectively see I have a subscription admin. If I wanted to, I could add a new role. So I could say I'm going to have a contributor role or reader role that has read-only access to the data, and I could basically specify a username. Or if you want to, you could even invite someone by their email address and give them read-only access to log into the portal to see just those settings for that particular resource. And so the beauty is you can set it at any level, All of it's logged, and it's a pretty good way you can actually lock down the security of your systems. And even if you're not worried about someone hacking you, it's still just a good general practice so that you don't inadvertently make a change that you thought was a dev test change, but actually was it to a production version of your app you have running. And then last but not least, in terms of features, we have resource tags that are now available. Who here is using resource tags? Who here has any idea what I'm talking about? Okay, good. So what a resource tag does is it's a really nice way that you can now go to every resource you have in Azure or every resource group you have in Azure, and you can give it a declarative tag. And you can use these tags however you want. It's kind of a little bit like a hack, but we like to think of it as instead a really high-value feature. But it's really useful, trust me. So basically, some examples. You could have a tag called creator. In other words, who is the person that created this resource? You could have department cost center. In other words, who should we charge for this resource when the bill comes? You could have environment. Is this dev test or production? And you can basically tag anything you want, resource group or individual resource with this. And then you can then use it to better manage the system itself. And so if we go in here super quick, let me switch back to, go back here and select this one right here. And what I did was I actually created a couple different tags on individual resources that I have. I'm assuming the internet will load. We'll see this in just a second. But basically what I can do is I can tag any individual resource, again, with any key value pair that I want. And I'll give it another 10 seconds, otherwise we'll give up. I don't know if someone's running something else through the internet, but suddenly the networking got very slow. But anyway, I can basically tag whatever I want within it. And then inside the portal, I can actually click on Browse by Tag, and I can go ahead and actually say, show me all the dev test resources, so show me everything for this department, and I can basically filter and view it inside the portal. The other nice thing about it is our new billing API that's about to go live will allow you to actually see the tags on the resource, and so for billing purposes, you can actually take your tags and use it to charge departments or do better accounting of your resources if you're looking for someone else to pay for them. And then last but not least, there's a whole bunch of cool features inside the portal that allows you to customize things better. This is something a lot of people don't know about, but it helps you, let's see if this internet came back. It still didn't come back. One last try and then close everything else out to see. I'm not actually getting anything back. Hopefully no one else after me has a demo, or else someone can work on what the networking thing is. But anyway, this is a cool way. Click on anything you can customize. You can customize the dashboard however you want. And it was going to be a pretty cool way to end the demo, but it seems like the network just went down. So, but anyway, that's a quick end-to-end view of Azure. I'm a little bit over time, so I'm going to wrap up here. Lots of stuff we hopefully showed here, give you a taste in terms of end-to-end across the platform, some of the stuff you can do. Lots of features I didn't get a chance to talk about, but whether it's IaaS, infrastructure capabilities, whether it's platform capabilities, whether it's data, web, mobile, management, we've got a pretty rich set of offerings, and every day and every week, literally, we roll out new updates and it gets better. How many people here are MSDN customers? Great. If you're an MSDN customer, guess what? You can use Azure for free. You can sign up without a credit card. You can actually do everything I just showed here today. All of that is public and live, and you can do it using your MSDN subscription. You get up to 97% off when you sign up and use MSDN off of resources when you use it for dev test. And basically, every subscription gets free resources built in. So if you're like a premium customer, you get £65 a month of resources, which is enough to run 3 VMs for 16 hours a day, 80 VMs for a 20-hour load test, or up to 500 websites plus a SQL database. All at no charge. And then if you want to, you can always put in your credit card and do even more than that. But this is a great way that you can actually use Azure, try it out, learn how to build apps with it, and get started. It works both with live IDs or Microsoft accounts. You can also set up your Active Directory. It will also work if your MSDN subscription is managed by your enterprise. And we're also adding the ability where if an enterprise or company wants to buy an MSDN account or MSDN subscription themselves and manage it themselves and give it to their employees, you can do that as well. So to learn how to get started, visit azure.microsoft.com, and hopefully you can find samples and docs for everything I showed here today, and looking forward to seeing what you build with it. So thanks a bunch.
That's good. Okay. Right, Scott, thank you so much. That was absolutely fantastic. I was thinking all the way through that, you were here nearly 3 years ago, about two and a half years ago, and the amount of innovation that's happened and at this incredible pace has been fantastic. So what we're going to do is we've got about 25 minutes, 26 minutes to be exact, and we've got two fantastic companies, and so we've created a section called Pitch to Scott. Where Scott, if you want to take a seat, and we're going to have Just Giving come up first of all. We've got the Chief Analytics Officer Mike Bagembe and the team lead for the Big Data Project, Mike Unwin, and followed by Ad Selim Technologies, and Scott is going to be discussing with them. Their architecture, so you can see some real-world case studies. So I'll let these guys introduce themselves. Over to you.
Great. Thank you. So I'm Mike. I'm the Chief Analytics Officer for Just Giving. And like Scott, I want to ask, who's used Just Giving before? If you could have a raise of hands. I won't judge your generosity. But that's pretty good. For those who don't know, we're a tech for good organization, and we have some pretty big ambitions. Our main ambition is to ensure that every great cause gets the funding that it requires. And a great cause doesn't have to just be a charity. It could be you raising money for the playground that you used to play in, or getting technical equipment for a school. And we've done okay. To date, we've managed to raise about $3 billion for good causes, and about 22 million of you have used our platform. But this is what we want to talk to you specifically about today. You see, about 2 years ago, we did a few experiments, and we managed to find that we could fundamentally change the giving space. Change the way you and I interact with giving, with the giving space as a whole. And we found that if we applied four specific themes, some machine learning, some behavioral economics, a lot of data, and most importantly, graph theory, the whole giving space would change and fundamentally. It would just be a completely different place. And a lot of this was done as experiments, but we managed to put this together. We're now able to put it into our product, and that's what we're going to talk about in a bit more detail. But in order to do this, we had to get our machine to learn four different things. And the first thing is what you see over there at the moment. We had to get the machine to understand what the world of giving looked like and get it to look and understand the world of giving in a machine way. So it started to look at things just as you see on the screen at the moment. People connected to people, people connected to causes that they care about, people supporting other people that they care about. And then we had to teach the machine three other different things. The first of those is the orange circle that you see on there, what we call the cause ontology. We had to teach the machine with the training set to understand what is a cause, what does a cause do, who does it support, and where does it operate. And then we go on to two of my favorite algorithms. The first one is what we call the matching engine. And that was an algorithm that could determine exactly what you as an individual cares about. You said machine learning can get pretty scary. This can get pretty amazing. But we're doing it for good purposes, ethical purposes. We want to make a really big difference. And so this machine can work out at a specific point in time what you care about, because believe it or not, what you care about changes. It changes with your circumstances. It changes with your relationships. I've always cared about children, but I care about children completely differently after I became a parent. If your great-grandfather or somebody you know suffers from something, what you care about changes. And it's really important that the machine gets an understanding of this. And last but not least is my favorite and the most sophisticated algorithm that we've built. It's called the Pathfinder. This uses techniques in behavioral economics, a lot of machine learning, to try and understand exactly how to interact with you as an individual. It specifically works with you to work out how to get you to be engaged, how to get you to be really passionate about the cause that you care about, and most of all, how to inspire you to do something about the cause that you care about. So Just Giving as a whole platform is changing. And Mike will talk a bit more about the technical aspects of how we're able to achieve all of these four things. And all of it, by the way, manifests in our feed, which is a new part of the product that was released towards the end of last year. You get a small glimpse of it over there. And that's where all of this intelligence, all of this machine learning surfaces up onto our product and getting people to use it. And we're already seeing some fantastic results. Mike, I'll hand over to you now if you want to talk in a bit more detail about it.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mike. So I'm going to talk through some of the architecture which we use to build the GIF graph and how that works and feeds into our user feed. So essentially, we have a couple of processes. We have a batch process and we have a real-time process. I'll talk first about the batch process because really that's the backbone of where we do the hard work. At the center of this, we use HD Insight, which is where we're able to do our graph calculations at scale, really. And it's HD Insight that allows us to do this. This is where we can work out who you're connected to, maybe even who you might know, how strong those connections are, which causes you're connected to and which causes that you care about. And it's really HD Insight that allows us to do this in batch. So if you look at the diagram down here, over here, this is a kind of overview of our batch architecture. And this is how we build the feed. And the feed, as Mike said, is essentially a way for us to put content which is personal and relevant to you and which shows what your social network is doing within JustGiving. So back to the architecture. What we do is essentially we load data from our on-premise SQL into Azure blob storage on a nightly basis. And this sits there at rest waiting to be processed in HD Insight. And then once we're ready, once the data's uploaded, at some point in the morning, we set off a Azure scheduler. And this puts a message onto a queue. And we've got some C# code, which is sitting in a worker role, which essentially orchestrates the whole batch process. And this is responsible for spinning up the HD Insight cluster, sending the batch according to the instructions to the cluster, which the batch being a series of MapReduce jobs. And then once the jobs have finished, it monitors them and makes sure they run successfully. And once the jobs are finished, it then shuts down the cluster. And one of the great things about HD Insight is that we only actually pay for the cluster whilst we're using it. And the data that we get from the insights afterwards sits there at rest in blob storage, and we can do with it what we like at a later point in time. So what we do next is we move that data using some more worker roles and some more C# code into table storage. And there it sits, ready for our APIs to consume. So on the retrieval side, again, we rely a lot on PaaS. And again, I'd like to actually say that PaaS is something that is really important to us with Azure, because we're quite a small team, and it's really enabled us to really focus on the business value of our code without having to worry about the infrastructural side so much. So what we're using here is the Azure websites for our APIs. We make use of the Azure Managed Cache. And what we do is we pull all of the data that we've gained from HD Insight plus some other data sitting in table storage, and we combine that together to form the final version of the user timeline. And in this way, because we've got the data stored in a sort of relatively denormalized way, and it's only the sort of the last sort of 10% of the computation we need to do on the website, we can serve these timelines up ranked in sort of pretty much zero latency across all of our 22 million users. So the last thing I'd like to talk about is the real-time element of this. So obviously with a social feed, it's important to keep it up to date. So if I send you a message during the day, or if you make a donation to my page during the day, I probably want to see that straight away on my feed. And we use the real-time process to do that as well. It also runs a lot of our other background operations as well, such as working out trending pages and also keeping our cause ontology updated. So the way we've done this is we've used Service Bus and we've used F# mailboxes. And this is something we actually partnered with ElastiCloud on to build. And what we've done is we've built a kind of actor-based framework from this, and it harnesses the Service Bus and F# mailboxes. So what happens is an event gets published onto the Service Bus, and this is actually a brokered message which contains an F# discriminated union type. And what happens is we bind these F# mailboxes to the Azure Service Bus, and they're competing to listen for these messages. And when they get the message, they're able to do some pattern matching on the message and then run a process according to that message. And if that's part of a longer pipeline of processing, then what they do is they put another message back onto the queue. And this way, we can scale out horizontally very nicely. And we just add more virtual machines running in the worker role or add more agents, and we get more throughput. And the last thing that's actually worth mentioning with this, and again, it's Service Bus doing a lot of the heavy lifting, there is a concurrency issue. So if you're writing to If you're updating lots of timelines, one thing you don't want to do is update one timeline at the same time with two different agents. And we actually harness the power of these service bus session IDE queues for this. And this is just a case of just going into the Azure Management Portal and checking a tick box to say, I'll have a session IDE service bus queue. And what this allows us to do is when at the final part of the process where we're actually about to write to the timeline, we put that message onto a session IDE service bus queue. And that creates its own actor, which is bound to that session for the lifetime of the session, and it will be destroyed at the end of the session, so nothing else can bind to that session. So we can ensure that we've only got one F-sharp mailbox or actor writing to one particular timeline at a time. So that's pretty much a quick kind of oversight of some of the processing that we've got in Azure. I can't believe how much has gone into Azure in the last year. I started working on Azure about a year and a half ago now, and it's amazing to see how much new technology there is already coming into the product. And we've really found that being in the cloud has really kind of allowed us to really focus on business value in writing our code, and it's given us opportunities that probably wouldn't have been there before. So thank you very much for listening, and thank you. That's it.
So we've got 5 minutes for a dialogue for Scott to ask questions and voice thoughts and opinions, and also for anybody in the audience to chip in if they feel like it.
No, this is awesome. I mean, we actually did not script this out, so I actually had no idea what I was about to see. I think there's a bunch of great elements for a solution like this, which is, you know, it kind of ties into conveniently a lot of the stuff that I talked about in terms of, you know, the mobile and web experience, how do you do it in real time, the machine learning, the big data, the analytics. And, you know, the thing I love about this is it's, you know, for a really good cause. And, it's kind of pretty awe-inspiring to see. So this looks fantastic.
Thank you.
I don't know if there are questions from the audience in terms of the specifics on it.
Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah, as I said, in the last year, so when we started on Azure a year ago, it looked very different to how it does today. And there's so much in there now that I'd like to incorporate. Absolutely, yeah. Certainly with things like Storm coming online and streaming analytics as well. Azure ML is going to be a big one for us, I think, as well for our data scientists. Absolutely late.
My sense is also like Spark once it comes online.
Yeah, right. Spark as well, yeah.
Being able to do kind of queries in real time.
In fact, yeah, we're looking at Spark via Elasticsearch Brisk at the moment as well as an option for us, which looks really good.
And being able to process things real time is essential for us because, like I said, people's decision process and what you care about is so fluid. It's important for us to be relevant and personal to you at that specific time.
So. I think it's a great example of like when you look at, you know, you kind of mentioned, you know, people with children or people with, grandparents that have certain, have died from certain diseases and things like that in terms of how that adjusts giving. And I think it's a great example for a very good cause of how, you know, adding some of that machine learning analytics into the contribution workflow, can dramatically impact people's willingness to give and or connect them to other, you know, particular charities or good locations where they can direct their dollars or pounds, I guess in this case. I think that's sort of, it's one of those things where I think for a lot of people that have worked on systems which interact with customers, you know, we're very used to a very rigid form or recommendation system or where it's, you know, someone's come up with the five or six different rules. You know, part of the interesting thing about some of the machine learning is when you run the analysis, you know, you see trends that you wouldn't otherwise see, and it's not magic, it's just statistics.
Yeah.
But you can start to see, oh, people in this part of the country or, you know, that you know, have a parent and a grandparent in this kind of class, you know, you can actually start to see patterns that even they don't know about. And again, it's based on the actual data that you're seeing flow through the system, so it constantly gets better and improves. And I think you're going to see more and more systems like that really light up and take advantage. And it's great to see that it's doing it for a really good cause.
I'll just add that it was a challenge. And, of course, there were skeptics when we started a lot of this work. People didn't believe you could actually build a machine that could better predict what somebody could care about. And what was great is when you have data, you can do experiments. And we've done a lot of experiments working with a lot of academics. And traditional methods of trying to solicit giving or trying to encourage people to be inspired about a specific cause, they do pretty well. They do about 30% better than random. When we tested our machine against the same sample set, the machine did in excess of 91% better. So what's great is now we have a lot of evidence to prove that actually this is going to work. So.
Fantastic. Great work.
Thank you.
Hello, am I on?
Yep. Hi, everyone. My name's Paul Payne. I'm a co-founder and CTO of AdSelum Technology. AdSelum is Latin for to the sky. It's a Latin terminology, and we're a legal software house. So that's where that comes from. Once you've registered a limited company name that no one can pronounce, first thing you do is get yourself a better product name. So I'm here today to talk about Matamojo, which is our legal service for law firms to help lawyers manage their caseloads more effectively. Very briefly, I'll just run through our timeline as a company. We're a BizSpark startup. We started out around March 2013. From there, we kind of got ourselves out into the marketplace, talked to as many law firms as we could, did a bit of market research, and then really started work in earnest on a product in around 2014, January. In August last year, we started working on the BizSpark Plus program, which has given us lots of access to Windows Azure, allows us to experiment and really just take advantage of all the different resources and different types of things we can do on there. That's really helped us to start our preview program and just get the product out there, get as many people using it as possible. And then a very big milestone for us was launching our first product, Matamojo for Business, which went out only a few weeks ago. Normally I'd spend about 20 minutes on this slide telling people how, you know, subscribe to Matamojo, it'll make all your wildest dreams come true. How many lawyers are there in the audience? Yeah. thought so. So we'll skip across this slide fairly quickly and get to the technical bit, which I'm sure everyone's much more interested in. But effectively, Matamojo is a subscription service. You pay monthly, and it allows you to manage your clients, your legal matters, elements of CRM, task management, and also some elements of risk management in there as well. Very briefly, we've just got a slide so you can see what the product looked like. We're mainly a browser-based solution at the moment, excuse me, so it's a web application. We've also done some work with Windows Phone, but we're going to be looking at using Xamarin to try and get us a bit more cross-platform sharing of code and allow us to target Android, iOS, and Windows Phone, and that's something we'll be focusing on this year. Okay, so to get to our main slide, I'll start here in the middle. So Matamojo is a multi-tenanted web application. So we have a number of web roles where all the main web pages are obviously served. We've also got a background worker, which allows us to hive off some of the more resource-intensive workloads that we do. For example, conflict checking is something that law firms require to make sure there's no conflict of interest when they're taking on a new client or a new case. And that's something that we push off to the... my slides have changed around very slightly here. No, it's all right, there we are. I have some problems with these over the weekend, I think. So, yeah, we're using Service Bus to allow our worker role to communicate. And we're also using Service Bus Relay to allow us to connect to on-premise solutions and actually consume some of the search data that exists in a lot of people's old legacy databases. Using Service Bus Relay, we can connect to their on-premise solution and pull their data back out into the cloud, which is really great. A couple of other things that's worth pointing out in our architecture. So we use SQL Azure. There are quite a few privacy issues with working in the legal industry. A UK data center would be a nice addition and would help us out a lot. But I noticed also you put transparent database encryption is coming soon, and that's really going to help us with our adoption in terms of trust in the data space. At the moment, we've got database per tenant, and there's so much great stuff in SQL Azure that allows us to It just takes the headache away from us of managing backups, recovery, replication, things like that are all just taken care of. So that's been a real boost for a small company, a startup. It just makes a world of difference. Very briefly, I'll just talk about our security mechanisms. So we use Azure Active Directory to secure the application. There's two different modes. I'll talk about the other one in a second. But the main mode that we've used for our Matamojo for Business product is for people who don't actually have an Azure Active Directory. We've created our own. And then every time someone signs up, we just create a group in Active Directory for that particular tenant and secure it that way. I won't go into too much detail on the other services, because obviously we're talking about Azure and Microsoft here, but there's various other systems that we've integrated with to allow us to do the subscription sign-up and use a voice for feedback. So as I say, a couple of weeks ago, we launched our first product, Matamojo for Business. Hopefully this week, all being well, we'll be launching Matamojo for Office 365, and because we're built on top of Azure Active Directory for our security, any lawyer or law firm who subscribed to Office 365 will be able to single sign on into our service. At the moment, that's really the main aspect that we've been working on, but we'll also be working on ensuring that they can get access to their Matamojo cases directly from with Outlook. And you can see there, that's one of the apps for Office that we've done there, plugging into an Outlook pane. I'll just finish on something that's really pertinent to the kind of scale that Azure gives us. The market opportunity in the UK for our kind of work, you'll see there that there's around 135,000 licensed lawyers in the UK. If you look at the US, that goes up to 1.2 million. The US legal software market is a lot bigger than the UK. So what Azure has allowed us to do is that when we launch our Office 365 service this week, not only can we put our data center, our data in the Dublin data center, we've also decided to launch simultaneously over in the US. So that's given us kind of global reach that as a small company we could only really have dreamed of a few years ago. Now we can quite easily roll it out across two different regions and with all the other different data centers. You know, Australia is quite a key one for us because the legal industry is fairly similar over there. The practice of law is quite similar. So the world is our oyster, I guess. And all I can say, it's been great using Azure. Thanks to Scott.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's pretty cool about the solution you walked through is the, you know, how you can now build kind of solutions that you can then kind of really easily package up in a SaaS-like offering and really offer to companies. And there's a whole bunch of solutions today that I think are very people-intensive or very manual that people subscribe to that, you know, now being able to offer as a SaaS, you know, you can make it just incredibly easy for anyone to adopt. And I think, you know, as we talk about cloud in general, you know, I think one of the things that we're increasingly seeing is people that say, hey, I really, if there is a SaaS solution out there, I really want to be able to just adopt it because that gives me even better productivity than having to manage my own VMs. But then also, I want to be able to extend it, and I want to be able to integrate it within systems. And so in the same way that you're integrating with Office 365, you could in turn offer APIs that could allow, you know, a local solution integrator or allow the company to further integrate within their own workflow.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, I think it's definitely a case where the number of developer jobs is going to increase dramatically. But also, I think the sophistication of what the customer experience looks like increases.
Yeah, I think we're starting to look at what we can do in the legal space differently with things like machine learning. Mm-hmm. Certainly the API management feature is something that we're really quite interested in, and just being able to let people kind of consume their own data and data we might pull in from other sources. That's going to be really great.
Yeah, and my sense is like even taking things like search, being able to take the actual legal text, but then be able to score it based on relevancy or geolocation or, you know, there's a bunch of different scenarios, you know, the recent case law or, you know, who names, I mean, but you can basically
kind of... limits are endless now, I think, really. It's just figuring out which is the best thing to do.
Yeah, and I think the global part is another one that you kind of mentioned, which is, you know, I think a way that also companies can now expand that, you know, if you were selling packaged software in Australia in the past, you'd have to have a, you know, local, you know, office and a local, you know, much more of a local presence. The ability to kind of package it up and manage it remotely here from London, you know, really enables you to enter a global market. And, you know, my sense is Hong Kong also has a legal system that's similar. It's, you know, there's you know, we're opening up in India. There's lots of other locations where you could start to enter geography-wise.
It's interesting because I think our main worry when we first started out in the company was if we expanded, how would we actually support kind of these applications from a technology perspective. Now it's more the human side of it. It's like we can suddenly deploy all this stuff all over the globe, but we've got various time zones and things to worry about. So it kind of shifts in a nice way, really. Now we've just got to focus on how we service those customers.
Cool. That's great. Any questions from the audience?
Cool. It was just about sort of what the reaction of your club. I work in a similarly highly regulated industry.
Yeah, sure. It's been a challenge. I think smaller firms are more open because they kind of have, I suppose they look at the trade-off between having extremely secure servers in their own premise versus, you know, the kind of flexibility and the power and the cost reduction that they can have in the cloud. But it is, I won't lie, it is a real challenge actually in our sector to get people to adopt, and that's one of the main reasons we've invested in trying to roll this thing out a bit wider and just kind of get a taste for how things are over in the States. Certainly there is a little less regulation, I think that will be easier for us, but a UK data centre and encryption and all those other good things will help if it came.
Yeah. We're certainly seeing in terms of... I would say even like comparing now to 12 months ago or 6 months ago, and you know, I think it depends on the industry, it depends on the geography, but the opinions about cloud have changed quite a bit. And it's, you know, typically you see in an adoption cycle, you kind of see a slow ramp and then a very hockey stick kind of growth in terms of opinions changing. And you know, it's customers that I had talked to a year or 18 months ago that said, look, we're never going cloud. You know, in the last 6 months that I've talked to, and they've said, yeah, we have a plan to be 100% cloud in 3 years. And you're like, whoa, what just changed? And, you know, some of it is people waiting to see who goes first. You know, my sense in this profession, once you get the top law firm adopting it or a top 10 law firm adopting it, you'll suddenly see a whole bunch of people, you know, say, oh, okay, if they're doing it, then I'll do it as well. Yeah. And so, you know, we're certainly seeing that effect where, you know, when people ask us, so who in my industry are doing this? And you mentioned two other kind of competitor partners of theirs, and they say, oh, okay, then I'm in. Yeah. You know, CIOs are naturally more risk-averse, and so if they feel like, hey, there's a couple other people like me that are doing it, then they feel more comfortable. You know, it's kind of my sense that it'll probably kick in. And I think a lot of it is going to be as you add more richer services to different apps, you know, the machine learning capabilities of you know, that we saw in the previous one, you know, you could also apply here in terms of, you know, looking at. And I think one of the things that we're also starting to see with cloud-based solutions is when you can aggregate training data from multiple locations, your actual solution gets richer. And so being able to, even though you got to be careful not to kind of mix customer data up, but if there's insights that your machine learning models can glean from the aggregate data that you can then apply with the appropriate controls in place for a specific customer, you know, in some ways the data and the knowledge about the data becomes more valuable than the app itself. And there's a whole bunch of use cases, whether it's predicting oil or predicting, you know, fraud or predicting, you know, tax policies that, you know, once you train the app with enough data, it's the training of the data that's actually more, you know, is the really valuable piece. And it becomes one of those cases where people can't afford not to actually adopt the service because they get so much value out of it they couldn't get just with their own segment of data by itself.
Yeah, I think we've really just added enough into the product so far, really, their table stakes, to just get us into the market.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure once we start to really get some good feedback and figure out where to take the product next, there's so many great things that we could do. Yeah, really looking forward to it.
Cool. Well, that's great. Thank you.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks, Scott. That was a fantastic talk this morning. Thanks to JustGiving and AdSelim. I think we have to vacate the theatre now, but we've got a networking area outside for how long? About 20 minutes? For a half hour, and I think Scott's going to be around. But it's probably best if we leave the theatre, and maybe if you're lucky, you can grab some of Scott's time after.
Cool. Thank you, everyone, for coming.